Until the philosophy which all one race superior and another inferior is finally and permanently discredited and abandoned. Now everywhere is war. There is no longer first class or second class citizens of invasion. Star. Until the color of a man's skin is of no more significant than the color of his eyes. Got to stay warm. Until the basic human rights are equally guaranteed to all, without regard to race. Until that day, the dream of lasting peace, world citizenship, and the rule of international morality will remain as a fleeting illusion to be pursued but never attained. Now everywhere is one. Still one. War in the east. War in the west. War up north. War down south. Some dying. Some crying. The noble and unarmed regime that all my children in Africa, yeah, in Africa, yeah, some human bondage must be toppled, until it is destroyed. Now everywhere is war. African continent will not know peace. We Africans will fight. We find it necessary. We know we shall win, as we are confident in the victory of good over evil. Of good over evil. Of good over evil.
Var fjärde.
African continent will not know peace. We Africans will fight. We find it necessary. We shall win, as we are confident in the victory of good over evil, of good over evil, of good over evil, of good over evil, of good over evil. Now everywhere is why?
Need no more trouble.
No.
Okay, let me finish this little piece that we were reading. Maybe you can pull that back up on there, that light, sweetheart. This is a very good thing to, because we're bringing ourselves, we're just going to read this one sentence before. We were reading a piece here from the Arcturians. Called The Changing Realities. The Arcturian message is from Susan Nelly, PhD, SUZANNELIE, just one L, NELIE, PhD, dot blogspot, dot N as in Nelly, L as in Lee. Okay. That's good. And then it's got /2/2014/05/, and then the name of the article with the hyphens between it, The Changing Realities, and then another hyphen, part-3-arcturian.html. And we were at this section where it was making it clear that, I'm going to back up just one here. When the frequency of their consciousness dropped to the frequency of the form they were visiting in this dimension of 3D, they were no longer spirit visiting form. Rather, they were spirits trapped in form.
That's
what got us in trouble, because we got addicted to all these 3D fun things.
You got in the body.
Money is never body. Sex is never sex. It's always something else. So anyway, we go.
Yeah.
So the trapped spirits then knew the experience of death,
right,
which was never experienced when they were spirit, because they lived infinitely while within the unity of the One. Worse yet, the Atlanteans did not take responsibility for the creation of their own problem. Instead, they blamed the one for punishing them and making them stay within their decaying, dying earthen vessels. Therefore, they separated themselves from the One, as well as from their own spirit beings within their physical forms. They polarized the One into gender deities of God or Goddess. This final separation from the One cemented their fate into the long decline into beings of form rather than beings of spirit. Spirit was always within them, yet they had evicted it from their minds. Hence, they could no longer experience their own spirit through their physical perceptions. For this reason, their inner spirit became a distant hierarchical ruler who was either was either a male god or a female goddess. Once spirit became polarized in their consciousness, the battle between god and goddess was focused on the battle between female Lemuria and male Atlantis. My way or the highway again. Here we go. Lemuria and Atlantis had peacefully coexisted for millions of years. However, the Atlanteans were conflicted and needed to vent their anger onto others. Therefore, that which was meant to be the blissful marriage of masculine and feminine that would return Earth into her spirit form and usher in personal and planetary ascension became instead a long and violent divorce. Lemuria was to be the matrix for the feminine, receptive, emotive, and creative aspect of logical and scientific aspect for future humanity. On the other hand, Atlantis was to be the masculine expression, logical and scientific aspect of future humanity. Both of these realities resonated to a frequency that we would now call the fourth dimension. It was not within the divine plan to create a reality at the third dimension, for the separation from spirit would make future evolution too difficult. Unfortunately, after the fall of these two great worlds, especially the fall of Atlantis, Earth was so shaken on her axis that it was impossible for Gaia to maintain a connection with her fourth dimensional resonance. Gaia called out to spirit to send light beings to assist her as she was on the edge of falling off her axis. Like we said, we didn't get back into the Milky Way galaxy until 2006, December 5th and 6th. Millions of loving light beings took forms made of the same elements as Gaia. They hoped that as they could transmute the lower dimensional forms into a higher frequency, they would be able to assist Gaia to do the same. However, Earth was too wounded to resonate any higher than the third dimension. And that's the responsibility of those of us, brothers and sisters of ours, that destroyed Atlantis by destroying the Great Crystal. And remember, it went supernova, and actually it would have if it didn't have an intervention called the Ashtar Command and what's called the Belt of Isis being inserted like a Band-Aid. You know, like the stork on the moon. The moon is the stork, and then there's this blanket that's in the stork's mouth, the moon's mouth. And it's not even, we had two moons, and they're still sitting in Ganymede, right? Those two moons are still in Ganymede? Or where are those? They got destroyed, so we've got a fake moon.
Yeah.
As we listened to Richard, Richard said it wasn't all natural, the moon. You know.
I have heard that possibly we would get two moons before the end of 2020.
You mean the original ones would be reestablished from the etheric blueprint, and we have
however they create moons.
Metatron has the etheric blueprint.
Yeah, yeah.
You don't remember that?
Oh, I do.
You wouldn't be here without that. Oh. No, don't forget. Okay, where was I? Okay. Millions of loving light beings took forms and made of the same elements as Gaia. They hoped that as they could transmute the lower dimensional forms into higher frequency, they would be able to assist Gaia to do the same. However, Earth was too wounded to resonate any higher than the third dimension. Even though Gaia's consciousness resonated to the fourth dimension, her planetary body needed eons of healing before it could also resonate to the fourth dimension. Her planetary body did. Gaia's consciousness resonated the fourth, but her planetary body needed to also have that time to do that. It was then that the fourth dimension became the reality that vibrated in the aura of Gaia, and she became separate from her planetary body that resonated to the third dimension. That's why there's going to be another Earth, right? A new Earth. Rama.
Yeah.
Do your best. Mm-hmm. Okay, get yourself something like tea or something if you need to. Gaia called out to Spirit to send. Let's see. It was then that the fourth, the creators of the Earth experiment were very concerned about the absence of Spirit's integration into third-dimensional matter. They knew that matter separated from Spirit would create a very harsh world that would become increasingly polarized. It is the presence and the frequency of Spirit that would allow the life forms on, in, and above Earth to find and live within the unity of planetary consciousness. In a reality devoid of unity and planetary consciousness, the grounded humans would experience extremes of separation from each other and form their planet. In an attempt to make sense of their difficult lives, the ones who fell into darkness grew to believe that what they did was good for others. With such separation from Spirit, the Light Ones tainted their unconditional love of the One with the conditional love of their polarized reality, in which others had to follow their commands to deserve love. This manner of separation of male and female began in Atlantis while Lemuria was still in existence. The Atlanteans' increasing separation from Spirit set them on a ruthless plight to gain power over others. Worse yet, the others included the planet itself. On the other hand, Lemuria became so polarized to the feminine side that their emotions made them perceive what they wanted to see rather than what was actually occurring. Hence, they did not see that the Atlantean power systems were being used as weapons. In the end, both civilizations perished. Yet much was learned from this experiment. Of polarized reality on Earth, it was learned that both masculine and feminine energies must incorporate wisdom, power, and love within their Earth vessels to serve as the means to find their center. Hence, the threefold flame of wisdom, power, and love were placed in the high heart of all incarnating ones. Unfortunately, in most cases, this correction was useless. After the fall of Atlantis, the frequency of Gaia's body was so low that most humans were unable to connect with their high heart. Hence, most of their lives were spent in the business of survival. The priests and priestesses of the One carried their light with them into the new locations to which they fled. Unfortunately, many of those who thrived on separation took the darkness of power over others into the same locations. Hence, the extreme battle between light and dark was carried into the surviving realities. This battle cannot be won. However, it can be ended. Like any fire, it must have fuel to burn. As we calibrate, you know, it's just like, what's her, Buffy St. Marie. Mm-hmm. You know, they really are to blame for wars, the universal soldier. If there were no soldiers, there would be no war. That's the deal. As we calibrate the core and the cornerstone crystals to the fifth dimensional portions of Earth's planetary matrix, the third, fourth dimensional energy fields will no longer have a place to which they can attach. Hence, the third, fourth dimensional timelines will expand into a higher frequency or move on to another planet's third, fourth dimensional matrix. There are two Earths, and there have been since harmonic convergence. There have been two Earths, the new heaven and the new Earth, and the old Earth is wrapping itself onto another constellation called, what's that called again, Rama?
Herculobus.
It's like peeling off the orange of the fake reality, and the new Earth bursts itself. Yes, in this manner, those who are not yet complete with the experience of resonating to the third, fourth dimensional realities will simply switch reality as easily as one can switch into a different dream. With the recalibration of Gaia's planetary crystals, the portal into the fifth dimensional matrix of Earth will open wide, while the portals to third, fourth dimensional Earth will be rerouted to other planets, experimenting with the concept of polarity and separation. That's what we've been saying, and that's already happening. It's happening a lot. I received most of this information as a channel. This is from Sue, who channeled this. As a channel from the Arcturians in the summer of 2010. At that time, I did not really understand it and dared not publish it. We still had some very hard times and dark times ahead of us, and it was not safe to talk in such a direct manner about ascension and the real history of Gaia. In just 4 years, there have been so many changes that I feel I can share this information. I even know that many people will understand it fully and have likely received it themselves. Hooray for humanity! Hooray! What a beautiful soul. It is so nice to find another sister or brother on the path. And, you know, talking the same talk so we don't look like we're the weirdos on the block, huh? I don't know.
I don't mind being crazy.
I don't mind being crazy. That's what it means. K. Pacha, what did he say? After the cloud burst and torrential rain, the clouds disperse and the sun shines again. The rivers rise up and flow to the sea. The more I let go, the more I am free. Open up and let the sun shine in. After the big cloudburst of these last few weeks, we can figure that May will be somewhat less frustrating, yet now it can be like cleaning up after a wild party the night before. Mercury opposite Saturn this Friday, that was yesterday, is pretty sober. So keep the chin up. It will be worth it. That's it. That's all he said. That's all the man said. Okay, everybody. All right, I guess we jump into this thing here. We've got the White House Correspondents' Dinner on the horn. Let me see. I'm going to go down here. Let's see, where do I want to go? I'm not going to go all the way back.
No.
Let's see what this one is. Oh, that was May 1st, 2010, huh? Oh, that's interesting. What's this? Okay, let's start here. Okay, here we go, everybody. Oh, no, not there. It's still May 1st, 2010. Okay, let's back it up to back up the truck. Okay, let's do that. Okay, here we go, everybody. Let's enjoy this. Okay, gotta get out of my way, honey.
Man, welcome back to our special coverage of the White House Correspondents' Dinner. The president is expected to speak shortly. Shortly being the operative word here, we can tell you that they are just a few minutes behind there at the Washington Hilton inside the ballroom. They've given out some awards. Folks are starting to get in place, as you see there. When it happens, of course, we will have that for you live. President Obama's speech, Joel McHale after him. Right now, though, I want to talk about two things that make us especially intrigued about tonight. House of Cards and Scandal. Two of the biggest shows out right now. Both have the allure of Washington, all the drama, all the pressure, all the suspense, and they'll both play out in real life tonight at the White House Correspondents' Dinner. The Griot's Chris Witherspoon sat down with Tony Goldwyn, who of course plays President Grant on Scandal. Goldwyn attended the Correspondents' Dinner for the first time last year. He talked about what that was like.
I didn't get to meet the president last year. Hopefully I will this year.
Okay.
Darn it. I'm stalking him. The dinner was so much fun last year. You know, truly, there are just so many brilliant people that live and work in this community. Part of the fun of being here is it seems so crazy, really. I mean, this confluence of Hollywood and Washington and this mutual fascination that we have for each other. You know, for me, I've always been enamored, you know, kind of obsessed and fascinated by Washington and how it works, and being, you know, kind of a news junkie and a political junkie, kind of in awe of so many people that work here because I think they're so brilliant and understand the world in a way that I never will. It's so gratifying to be a part of a show that we love doing so much as we do Scandal, and the group of people that we have together and how passionate we are about it, that it resonates with the public in that way is incredible. You know, so that people chase me down the street because they love Fit, so they must have, you know, a picture with the president. That's just a testament to what Shonda Rhimes has created, you know, and the group of people she's put together to tell these stories.
Back here in Washington, D.C., Elahe Azadi from the National Journal, and e-correspondent Alicia Quarles as well. Also down in Miami, Dean Obadala, political comedian, columnist for the Daily Beast. President Grant there. President Underwood was here last year. What has Alicia Quarles, what is, you know, shows like House of Cards, shows like Scandal, what have those shows done for the perception of Washington, D.C., and the perception of politics in general?
They bring glamour to it. So you keep hearing it, this is called the Nerd Prom, but suddenly you see these TV shows bringing sexy to Washington, D.C., and also the President and First Lady will say when they are fans of shows like they are for Homeland, so usually Claire Danes is in the house. I talked with Tony earlier today from Scandal, and he said he went to the West Wing yesterday, and it was a trip to finally see it in person when he'd seen it on a set for so long.
That's funny. That's funny. Kevin Spacey was all the rage last year. He is not here this year. He's apparently out on tour of some sort, but I did spend some time with Michael Kelly earlier today, who of course plays the Chief of Staff on that show. There's some question, spoiler alert, there's some question about whether Kelly's character is going to be coming back next season. But he said to me earlier that he gets all kind of geeked out about being here for the White House. And you wouldn't think that an A-list actor would get so stoked about hanging out with politicians. I mean, most of whom, as you know, are not very exciting.
I mean, as someone who's in the halls of the Capitol every day when Congress is in session, I'm quite surprised at how geeked out they get about it. But then again, this is our world, and we're just used to being around it. And it's kind of this interesting, like, funhouse mirror where we're both looking at each other. Hollywood's looking at DC, DC's looking at Hollywood, and we're just so fascinated by what's usually normal to us. So it is pretty interesting to just watch it. I was interviewing actresses on Orange is the New Black. Yeah. They were giddy.
Love Laverne Cox, who we saw.
Exactly. She was just so excited. They were absolutely giddy, and I couldn't believe it. I said, why are you so excited for this? Yeah. They go, we're at the dinner. We've made it. And I was like, that's how people feel.
That's how they define it.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Dee, we'll get to you right after this. Our special coverage of the White House Correspondents' Dinner continues ahead. We're going to look at some of the topics that you will undoubtedly be hearing a lot about tonight.
But my prior experience has taught me how these dinners work. If the president laughs, everyone laughs. And if the Fox News table laughs, a little girl just fell off her bike.
Unfortunately, John McCain couldn't make it. Recently, he claimed that he had never identified himself as a Maverick. And we all know what happens in Arizona when you don't have ID. Adios, amigos.
President Obama there back in 2010 taking aim at one of his favorite targets through the year, Senator John McCain. But McCain's not the only person who, of course, will be taking some hits tonight when President Obama takes to the podium. In just a few minutes, of course, we will have that for you live right here on MSNBC. Joining me as we wait here in Washington, Elahi Azadi from the National Journal, e-correspondent Alicia Quarles, and from Miami, Florida, Dino Badala, political comedian, columnist for the Daily Beast. There is one quill in the president's comedic arsenal, Dean, that he has gone to again and again. Take a look, take a listen.
This next provision is called the Jersey Shore-Up. It reads, the following individual shall be excluded from the indoor tanning tax within this bill. Snooki, Jay Wow, The Situation, and House Minority Leader John Boehner. In the next 100 days, our bipartisan outreach will be so successful that even John Boehner will consider becoming a Democrat. After all, we have a lot in common. He is a person of color. Although not a color that appears in the natural world.
He can barely get through that one himself. Dean, too easy? Or, I mean, is Boehner a surefire laugh every day and twice on Sunday?
Sure, it's fine. And also, he says in an endearing way, it's not an attack like some of the slams. We've seen Obama do smackdowns. That's not what it's about with John Boehner. There's almost a warmth in his tone there. I think you will see him some smackdowns. I think you'll see Obama joke at the Republic's expense about hitting the Obamacare sign-up numbers that he wanted. I think you'll see maybe some jokes with the Koch brothers. Don't forget, last year he slammed Sheldon Adelson, so why not the Koch brothers? I think you'll see some fight, some about the Republican infighting, especially the jockey for president, maybe Rand Paul jokes, Chris Christie, Ted Cruz.
True.
You know, Chris Christie's at the CNN table. Maybe he'll joke about some kind of deal and not having the bridge closed for employees coming to Jersey to New York. Who knows what they'll say, but I think you're going to see that. Maybe even pop culture. His friend George Clooney got engaged, so maybe you'll see a George Clooney type of joke.
You know, I'm actually kind of surprised that Governor Christie is there tonight.
Why? You got to play. You got to win that.
So the characters we know, some of the characters who are probably going to get some fire, some incoming fire. Let's talk about topics here. NSA, DOJ maybe. You got a holder in the room there. Yeah. IRS.
Government shutdown.
Oh, that's right.
There's going to be a lot of talk about government shutdown.
Agreed.
Yeah. And the proponents of Obamacare Act. And also, like I said, he will actually give probably a shout out to George Clooney, who was defending his honor recently, so staunchly. Mm-hmm. In the past, he's gone after Ted Cruz, so that's fair game. He's gone after Michelle Bachmann, so everything's open.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, he really hasn't taken a hands-off approach. Yeah.
And what does he have to lose now?
That's a good point.
I mean, it is 2014. They want the Democratic base to come out, so it is important, but he's not up for re-election. Last year, you saw an attitude from the president, a very celebratory because he's coming off a win. And, you know, he might still have a little bit of that in him, given what's happening right now with Obamacare.
Yeah.
So I definitely do think Obamacare
will certainly be a theme. What were you about to say, Dean?
Well, don't forget, though, a couple years ago, he got in trouble for doing the drone joke. And it was a very innocent joke about the Jonas Brothers, really, about it protecting his daughter and saying, if you go near my daughter, I have two words for the Jonas Brothers, predator drone. And he got a lot of pushback for that. So I think if you see any jokes, perhaps, like about Benghazi, in fact, a Fox News anchor said just yesterday, President Obama should not do any jokes about Benghazi. And if you're in comedy, you know Fox News is a comedy channel, so you might want to listen to them because they do a lot of comedy in that channel.
We're going to squeeze in one more break here. We've gotten word that President Obama is close, so we want to take a quick commercial break. We have lots of bills here at MSNBC, so we're going to squeeze in one more when we come back. We expect President Obama to take the podium after the dinner, of course. After the party, the after party, then the holiday, then the hotel.
You know,
I'm kidding. We're going to look at some of the hottest bashes in town tonight.
I keep hearing how everyone is excited to go to the Bloomberg party. You know how I know I'm not in New York? In New York, no one is excited to go to a Bloomberg party.
A few secret provisions. And that's ridiculous. There aren't a few secret provisions in the healthcare plan. There are like hundreds.
Again, President Obama from 2010, we are about to see what he has up his sleeve for this year's appearance at the White House Correspondents' Dinner. I'm Craig Melvin, live in Washington, D.C. Thank you so much for joining us for this special coverage of the 100th annual, 100 years they've been doing this, not all, of course, at the Washington Hilton, but they've been over there for a number of years now. Just moments from now, there'll be a toast to the president, then we will get to the moment that we've all been waiting for, President Obama taking his shot at stand-up comedian again. That, of course, followed by what is among the toughest jobs in show business. The real comedian who has to follow that up this year is going to be Joel McHale. He is going to be in the hot seat, and we will be bringing it all to you live here on MSNBC. Continuing with me as we wait for Mr. Obama here in Washington, Alahi Azadi from the National Journal, e-correspondent Alicia Quarles, and from Miami, Dino Badala, political comedian, columnist for the Daily Beast. This is how things kicked off at last year's dinner.
It must be so hard to write jokes about a town that already is one. Democrats, Republicans, the White House, Congress, you all came together to make this spoof. That's what real bipartisanship looks like. I may lie, cheat, and intimidate to get what I want, but at least I get the job done. So I hope some of you are taking notes. Well, have a wonderful evening, and I'll see all of you at the Bloomberg Vanity Fair party. That is, those of you who got an invite. Oh, and Mr. President, welcome to Nerd Prom.
South Carolina's most famous politician right there, Frank Underwood.
Hey.
Alicia Quarles, any buzz at this point about which show might do something like that this year? I would imagine that the Scandal folks have been working on something, though.
No buzz just yet, because if you remember, the president took flack for the amount of videos last year and the things that he did. So Homeland's one of his favorite shows. It made sense that that was done. So, again, it's a little less Hollywood this year. It'll be interesting to see which shows show up.
Dean, is there any reason to believe that? Go ahead.
One thing, and I was just looking at the guest list of celebrities for the dinner. There are 7 cast members from Scandal that are going to be at the dinner tonight. So perhaps you're on to something. Perhaps there will be a Scandal video because we're all there to watch it. Now, we could be wrong, but that's the biggest cast of any show at the dinner tonight, as long as what I just read is completely updated. So I think it is. You know what you touched on before? The toughest job in show business, following the President of the United States, like President Obama, who kills comedically, and then as a comedian, to follow that, especially like Joel McHale, I really think, honestly, he's going to have a challenge that we haven't seen in the last few years. You had Conan O'Brien, who was well known. Seth Meyers, much better known. I think it's going to be a challenge for Joel. I don't think they're going to be rude to him. But even last year, Conan O'Brien, I remember we talked about this. He started out slow and then hit his stride and then started killing himself. I think for Joel, it's going to be a snark fest, so it might be tough. It might be challenging for him.
Hey, Dean, there have been some comedians in the past who have talked about one of the things that makes this particular gig so difficult, besides, of course, following the president, the acoustics of the room. That's not a room that's really conducive to getting a lot of laughs. Is that correct?
It's a huge room. If you play a room like that, and I've had a few shows actually in the Middle East where we had 2,000 or 3,000 people come out, but that was always in a very formal theater where the acoustics are perfect. This is a dinner event. You know, I just literally performed at a dinner political event right before I came here for Emerge USA. It's not the same acoustics. And I've done some political events, and as a comedian, it gets in your mind, the political people there, the elected officials, they become the celebrities. And I did an event for like 70 people for DCCC a few months ago for High Hitters. And you can see everyone's face. And on some level, that's a little bit more pressure than not being able to see anyone's faces. So when Nancy Pelosi walked in the middle of my performance, I watched her out of the corner of my eye. Is she laughing or not? So Joe has that one thing going from 2,000, over 2,000 people. If 50% laugh at a joke, that's 1,000 people laughing. It sounds pretty good.
Well, I think you hit it on the head. Joel has said that he's going in there to be funny. If the jokes aren't funny, no matter what the content is, it doesn't matter. Also, he took an academic approach to this. He called several of the former hosts of the White House Correspondents Dinner. He spoke to them. He really picked their brain. So don't underestimate Joel McHale.
Who did he call? Do you know?
He called Craig Ferguson. Yeah.
Conan.
Yep.
He sat with Conan or one of the previous hosts and asked them about
Joel is really, really smart. He's used to doing this quick hits on the soup.
It sounds like you think he's going to be fine.
I'm not just saying that because he's my brother. No, that's true. Joel, he's very, very quick, and he's not taking this lightly, so don't underestimate him.
I wish him the best, just so it's clear. I'm not wishing him ill. As a comedian, I root for other comedians.
No, Dean,
well.
No, just kidding.
He should have reached out to me on Twitter. I would have been available to give him some comments about playing 80 people in the back of a hamburger place. I would be perfect for that. But I really hope it goes well. I think as a comedian, objectively, tonight's especially challenging because he's not as well known as some of the past comedians.
I want to take a quick moment to sort of attempt to describe what's happening right now. Before the president gets up in that room, there are a lot of speeches. There are a number of awards that are given out as well. So that is what we are watching. Rest assured that we are listening. And when something important happens, we will, of course, bring the audio up full for you. Let's go back to 2005 for just a moment. That's when President Bush gave up his time for a very good reason, and it brought down the House.
Ladies and gentlemen, I've been attending these dinners for years and just quietly sitting there. Well, I've got a few things I want to say for a change. George always says he's delighted to come to these press dinners. Baloney. He's usually in bed by now. I'm not kidding. I said to him the other day, George, if you really want to end tyranny in the world, you're going to have to stay up later.
Elia Zadi, if President Obama, if he really wanted to bring down the House, he calls up Michelle Obama. That's something that we haven't seen just yet.
Totally, and maybe he'll do it during his last term. But I did want to make one other point. The dinner itself has come under criticism increasingly with each year that it doesn't focus enough on the press and actually honoring the press who it's supposed to be honoring. So right now, actually, I think a number of the speeches are to give awards to different journalists on the associations and scholarships as well. So that's another point to just make.
One of the other knocks, one of our fearless leaders here at the Peacock, Tom Brokaw, a couple of years ago, I believe, he criticized the dinner, and basically his criticism was that here you have the press corps who is supposed to be covering the president aggressively, covering the administration aggressively, and then all of a sudden you get together and it's really telling me you're drinking and you're bringing all these A-list celebrities, B-list celebrities, C-list celebrities, and it's turned into this sideshow of sorts. Is this a dinner that has devolved in some ways? And how do you respond? I mean, you cover the halls of Congress. How do you respond to that criticism that it's very difficult to cover an administration aggressively and do this as well?
Well, I mean, I think it's pretty fair to say that this administration is a very difficult one to cover. When you're on the Hill, it's a little different because there are 535 of them, and so there are a lot of people to talk to. But I think it's also important to note that who's actually in the room, it's not only just journalists. A lot of media organizations just aren't bringing journalists. They're bringing their sources as well, and that's really what the dinner originated as reporters bringing their sources. It's a way to kind of be together in an informal environment.
How did it turn to this?
So, actually in the late 80s, a Baltimore Sun reporter brought Fawn Hall, who was the secretary
right.
at the center.
Yes,
at the center of Iran-Contra. And that really became sort of a spectacle. And from there, it kind of turned into something else.
It just went downhill.
And then
Lindsay Lohan
brought Lindsay Lohan and Kim Kardashian. But you know what? Fox News and Greta's Table got a lot of headlines and a lot of flack for that. But you look at this administration, Obama did Funny or Die, and guess what? The Affordable Care Act, the number of registrants went up hugely. So you can't separate the two. The Creative Coalition, a ton of actors were on Congress yesterday testifying. So it's all interlinked now.
Can we bring up the audio for just a second? Hang on 1 second, Dean.
Sure.
We posthumously grant him the membership. Finally. It'll be hard to see, but I want to direct your attention right in the middle of the room, table 104. I want to introduce you to Harry's son, Sherman McAlpin. Sherman, would you please stand?
This is Sherman McAlpin. Sherman McAlpin. That's Harry McAlpin's son. Tonight's dinner is not just about the glamour and the glitz as well. Those in attendance are also honoring, and right now this is a standing ovation for the first black member of the White House press corps. His name was Harry McAlpin. He was denied entry into the White House Correspondents Association. That's the group hosting tonight's dinner. He was denied entry because of his race, so he couldn't attend White House press conferences. He certainly couldn't go to dinners like this. Franklin Delano Roosevelt changed all of that. He allowed McAlpin into the briefing room. He was never actually admitted to the association, though. Tonight, though, as they celebrate their 100th anniversary, what you are seeing right now is the group honoring McAlpin by naming a scholarship after him. Michelle Obama there on hand to present the first Harry McAlpin scholarship. And other scholarships as well. We should note here that there was a time when women were also not allowed into the White House Correspondents Association. They certainly wouldn't be at this dinner as well.
That's right. I was going to say Helen Thomas was the first female member of the White House press corps who broke down that barrier. But something interesting about this particular journalist we're talking about was he actually tried to use his White House press pass, which he did receive. He was not a member of the association. He tried to use that to go cover Congress, and he was not admitted to the Capitol to do that. So this is a really remarkable moment where we're seeing 100th year of this dinner. We're seeing the country's first black president, and we're seeing this honor being given to this journalist.
He passed away in the mid-80s, and he was the first African-American to ask a question at a press conference to the president of the United States. So he, you know, broke barriers, but was never properly honored in his day.
We're going to pause here for just a moment. And, you know, this has to be a highlight, I would imagine. This is one of those lifetime highlights for a lot of the young people who are getting some of these scholarships. They get to meet President Obama, and probably a bigger deal for a few of them, Michelle Obama as well on hand, who is looking stunning and radiant as ever. We're going to come back. I want to talk about that dress a little bit.
Oh, okay. Let's do it.
President Obama expected to speak in just a few moments at the Washington Hilton. When that happens, we will, of course, bring it to you live right here on MSNBC. And welcome back to our special coverage of the White House Correspondents' Dinner tonight. Alahi Azadi is here in the studio. Alicia Quarles is here in the studio. Dean Obadala joining us down in Miami, Florida. Let's talk about Michelle Obama here, Alicia Quarles. We just saw her before the commercial break. I think we're going to see her again in just a few moments. We don't control this camera. Our friends over at C-SPAN do, so hopefully they'll give us a shot here in just a few moments. That's a heck of a dress.
Ask and you shall receive.
Who's she wearing?
Well, funny you should ask me that. She's wearing Marquesa. And I actually just interviewed the two designers, Karen and Georgina, yesterday. And they're all about empowering women. And they tweeted out honor that she's wearing this. Georgina Chapman is married to Harvey Weinstein. And Harvey is in the audience tonight, the film mogul.
Yeah.
So she's wearing Marquesa. Beautiful choice.
She has done a great deal, not just for young women in terms of, we can play this game all night with you're talking about fitness, whether you're talking about self-worth, whether you're talking about perception. I mean, what she's done for the world of fashion.
Huge.
Yes.
Huge. She wore that Jason Wu dress, young designer at the first inauguration, the dance, put him on the map. She has actually come into New York City to cut the ribbon at the Met Gala for Anna Wintour's newly opened wing. And that's why you see so many fashionable people coming tonight. I interviewed a ton of supermodels. Designer Tory Burch was there. My friend Cynthia Raleigh was there. The fashion community loves her because she's all about American designers.
I recognize about three of the names you mentioned.
That's okay. Yeah, you drew a blank.
I'm with you, Craig.
I'm with you, Craig.
I really am my world.
I've got some ties in that for 20 years. Go ahead, Dean.
What about, where's, who, what am I wearing, Alicia? Can you guess that? Today's
You're
man.
You're wearing
exactly.
a very presidential bow tie.
Thank you very much. I don't know who makes the dresses, but she looks fabulous. And the one time I got to meet her in a quick
Dean,
photo
Dean,
op.
I've got to cut you off here. This is Steve Toma. He is president of the White House Correspondents Association. He's making a few remarks. He's going to welcome the First Lady. And now he's toasting President Obama.
For me. I'd like to introduce the President of the United States by introducing the Vice President of the United States.
Hello?
Selena, what are you doing?
I thought you were the president. Hey, listen, are you going to this Correspondents' dinner tonight?
No, I'm not going, man. I've been there once. It's a bunch of politicians trying to explain politics to Hollywood. It's not worth it.
Exactly. I mean, who wants to see David Gregory crying in the corner all night? Hey, do you want to come and pick me up? Yellow? Seriously, yellow.
Dennis Clark.
Oh, yeah. This is the West. Oh, it's locked.
Anybody looking? Just check for me.
No? Oh, I'm going to remember that. Oh, yeah. Okay. Oh.
Whoa. No. Don't touch the desk. Don't touch the desk.
Okay.
Come on, let's get out and get something.
Yeah.
This is good. My granddaughters like the sprinkles.
Like the sweetest thing you can get in the executive branch.
Hey, guys. What are you doing?
Nothing.
What's in your mouth?
Carrots?
Hey, don't tell Joe.
Haven't you guys listened to anything I've said about healthy eating? Hand it over. Hand it over. You guys, come on, let's move.
Okay.
Busted.
Say that again.
Oh, what's good? Oh, I just forgot my purse, so...
I'm sure there are raisins in here.
It's a fruit.
Plus, it's more than they give you that correspondence dinner. Let me tell you. Plus, I work out every day.
Yeah, sure you do. I do, too.
You want to arm wrestle?
I don't really work out.
Yeah, I didn't think so.
So where are we headed next?
Rome, the real seat of power.
We can write any headline we want?
Knock yourself out. Don't do it.
The headline I'd like to write is Selena Meyer sworn in as president, but all in good time. Yes, we can all look directly into the camera, Kevin. The point is, you're not supposed to.
Selena, hi, Joe.
What are you doing here?
Getting my tattoo done. You know the difference between the tattoo and the Koch brothers?
No.
They're both painful, but you can get rid of a tattoo.
All right, let's do it.
I'm in. Bring it on.
Oh, yeah. Bring it on.
Hey, girl.
Hey, J-Dog, are you going to this dinner thing tonight?
Well, hell no, I'm not going there. We've got important things going on here in the Capitol.
Ooh, yeah. Okay, right. Thanks. You know what, Joe? I'm going to need to go to the dinner. You see, the thing is, I'm not really the VP, but you are. I'm an actress from Hollywood.
I know.
So can you give me a ride?
Hey, the Secret Service said let me drive off the property.
That makes no sense.
You can get a cab.
Yeah. I got my dress. And this hair. Thanks a million, Joe.
Good luck.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you so much. Everybody, please have a seat. Have a seat. Before I get started, can we get the new presidential setup out here? It's worked before. That's more like it. It is great to be back. What a year, huh? I usually start these dinners with a few self-deprecating jokes. After my stellar 2013, what could I possibly talk about? I admit it. Last year was rough. Sheesh. At one point, things got so bad, the 47% called Mitt Romney to apologize. Of course, we rolled out healthcare.gov. That could have gone better. In 2008, my slogan was, yes, we can. In 2013, my slogan was, control, alt, delete. On the plus side, they did turn the launch of healthcare.gov into one of the year's biggest movies. But rather than dwell on the past, I would like to pivot to this dinner. Let's welcome our headliner this evening, Joel McHale. On Community, Joel plays a preening, self-obsessed narcissist. So this dinner must be a real change of pace for you. I want to thank the White House Correspondents Association for hosting us here tonight. I am happy to be here, even though I am a little jet-lagged from my trip to Malaysia. The lengths we have to go to get CNN coverage these days. Still searching for their table. MSNBC is here. They're a little overwhelmed. They've never seen an audience this big before. Everybody is trying to keep up with this incredibly fast-changing media landscape. For example, I got a lot of grief on cable news for promoting Obamacare to young people on Between Two Ferns. But that's what young people like to watch. And to be fair, I am not the first person on television between two potted plants. Sometimes I do feel disrespected by you reporters, but that's okay. Seattle Seahawk cornerback Richard Sherman is here tonight, and he gave me some great tips on how to handle it. Jake Tapper, don't you ever talk about me like that. I'm the best president in the game. What do you think, Richard? Was that good? A little more feeling next time? While we're talking sports, just last month, a wonderful story. An American won the Boston Marathon for the first time in 30 years. Which was inspiring, and only fair since a Kenyan has been president for the last six. We have to even things up. We have some other athletes here tonight, including Olympic snowboarding gold medalist Jamie Anderson is here. We're proud of her. Incredibly talented young lady. Michelle and I watched the Olympics. We cannot believe what these folks do. Death-defying feats. Haven't seen somebody pull a 180 that fast since Rand Paul disinvited that Nevada rancher from this dinner. As a general rule, things don't end well if the sentence starts, "Let me tell you something I know about the Negro." You don't really need to hear the rest of it. Just a tip for you. Don't start your sentence that way. Speaking of Rand Paul, Colorado legalized marijuana this year. An interesting social experiment. I do hope it doesn't lead to a whole lot of paranoid people who think that the federal government's out to get them and listening to their phone calls. That would be a problem. And speaking of conservative heroes, the Koch brothers bought a table here tonight, but as usual, they used a shadowy right-wing organization as a front. Hello, Fox News. I'm just kidding. Let's face it, Fox, you'll miss me when I'm gone. It will be harder to convince the American people that Hillary was born in Kenya. A lot of us really are concerned about the way big money is influencing our politics. I remember when a super PAC was just me buying Marlboro 100s instead of regulars. Of course, now that it's 2014, Washington is obsessed on the midterms. Folks are saying that with my sagging poll numbers, my fellow Democrats don't really want me campaigning with them. And I don't think that's true, although I did notice the other day that Sasha needed a speaker at Career Day and she invited Bill Clinton. I was a little hurt. Both sides are doing whatever it takes to win. It's a ruthless game. Republicans, this is a true story. Republicans actually brought in a group of consultants to teach their candidates how to speak to women. This is true. And I don't know if it'll work with women, but I understand that America's teenage boys are signing up to run for the Senate in droves. Anyway, while you guys focus on the horse race, I'm going to do what I do. I'm going to be focused on everyday Americans. Just yesterday, I read a heartbreaking letter. You know, I get letters from folks around the country every day. I get 10 that I read. This one got to me. A Virginia man who's been stuck in the same part-time job for years. No respect from his boss. No chance to get ahead. I really wish Eric Cantor would stop writing me. You can just pick up the phone, Eric. Feeling sorry, believe it or not, for the Speaker of the House as well. These days, the House Republicans actually give John Boehner a harder time than they give me, which means orange really is the new black. The idea of working with Congress. In fact, 2 weeks ago, Senator Ted Cruz and I, we got a bill done together. And I have to say, the signing ceremony was something special. You got a picture of it, I think. Look, I know. Washington seems more dysfunctional than ever. Gridlock has gotten so bad in this town, you have to wonder, what do we do to piss off Chris Christie so bad? One issue, for example, we haven't been able to agree on is unemployment insurance. Republicans continue to refuse to extend it. You know what? I am beginning to think they've got a point. If you want to get paid while not working, you should have to run for Congress just like everybody else. Of course, there is one thing that keeps Republicans busy. They have tried more than 50 times to repeal Obamacare. Despite that, 8 million people signed up for health care in the first open enrollment. Which does lead one to ask, how well does Obamacare have to work before you don't want to repeal it? What if everybody's cholesterol drops to 120? What if your yearly checkup came with tickets to a Clippers game? Not the old Don Sterling Clippers, the new Oprah Clippers. Would that be good enough? What if it gave Mitch McConnell a pulse? What is it going to take? Anyway, this year I've promised to use more executive actions to get things done without Congress. My critics call this the imperial presidency. Truth is, I just show up every day at my office and do my job. You got a picture of this, I think. You would think they'd appreciate a more assertive approach, considering that the new conservative darling is none other than Vladimir Putin. Last year, Pat Buchanan said Putin's headed straight for the Nobel Peace Prize. He said this. Now, I know it sounds crazy, but to be fair, they give those to just about anybody these days. So it could happen. But it's not just Pat. Rudy Giuliani said, Putin is what you call a leader. Mike Huckabee and Sean Hannity keep talking about his bare chest, which is kind of weird. Look it up. They talk about it a lot. It is strange to think that I have just 2.5 years left in this office. Everywhere I look, there are reminders that I only hold this job temporarily. But it's a long time between now and 2016, and anything can happen. You may have heard the other day, Hillary had to dodge a flying shoe at a press conference. I love that picture. Regardless of what happens, I've won my last campaign, and I'm beginning to think about my legacy. Some of you know Mayor Rahm Emanuel recently announced he's naming a high school after me in Chicago, which is extremely humbling. I was even more flattered to hear Rick Perry, who's here tonight, is doing the same thing in Texas. Take a look. Thank you, Rick. It means a lot to me. And I intend to enjoy all the free time that I will have. George W. Bush took up painting after he left office, which inspired me to take up my own artistic side. I'm sure we've got a shot of this. Maybe not. The joke doesn't work without the slide. Oh, well. Assume that it was funny. Does this happen to you, Joe? It does, okay. On a more serious note, tonight reminds us that we really are lucky to live in a country where reporters get to give a head of state a hard time on a daily basis, and then once a year give him or her the chance at least to try to return the favor. But we also know that not every journalist or photographer or crew member is so fortunate. Because even as we celebrate the free press tonight, our thoughts are with those in places around the globe, like Ukraine and Afghanistan and Syria and Egypt, who risk everything, in some cases even give their lives, to report the news. And what tonight also reminds us is that the fight for full and fair access goes beyond the chance to ask a question. As Steve mentioned, decades ago, an African American who wanted to cover his or her president might be barred from journalism school, burdened by Jim Crow, and once in Washington, banned from press conferences. But after years of effort, black editors and publishers began meeting with FDR's press secretary, Steve Irwin. And then they met with the president himself, who declared that a black reporter would get a credential. And even when Harry McAlpin made history as the first African-American to attend a presidential news conference, he wasn't always welcomed by the other reporters. But he was welcomed by the president, who told him, "I'm glad to see you, McAlpin, and I'm very happy to have you here." Now, that sentiment might have worn off once Harry asked him a question or two. And Harry's battles continued, but he made history. And we're so proud of Sherman and his family for being here tonight, and the White House Correspondents Association for creating the scholarship in Harry's name. For over 100 years, even as the White House Correspondents Association has told the story of America's progress, you've lived it too, gradually allowing equal access to women, minorities, and gays, and Americans with disabilities. And yes, radio and television and internet reporters as well. And through it all, you've helped make sure that even as societies change, our fundamental commitment to the interaction between those who govern and those who ask questions doesn't change. And as Jay will attest, it's a legacy you carry on enthusiastically every single day. And because this is the 100th anniversary of the Correspondents Association, I actually recorded an additional brief video thanking all of you for your hard work. Can we run the video?
Congratulations.
What's going on? I was told this would work. Does anybody know how to fix this? Oh, thank you. You got it?
I got this. I see it all the time. There. That should work.
Congratulations to the White House Correspondents Association. Here's to 100 more terrific years. Thank you very much, everybody. God bless you. And God bless America, and thank you, Kathleen Sebelius. President Obama there, going about 20 minutes, leaving virtually no political stone unturned there in the Washington Hilton Ballroom, ending with Kathleen Sebelius, the, of course, immediate past head of the Health and Human Services Administration. Wow, that was pretty doggone funny. Alahi Azadi, Alicia Quarles, Dino Badala. What'd you think?
Yeah, I mean, my favorite joke out of all of that was the orange is the new black joke. That was really, really on point.
Let's listen in to Joel and we'll talk about it. We'll deconstruct after this.
Here we go. I am the last person standing between you and your after party. So in just an hour and 15 minutes, you'll be walking out of here, all right? I'm going to break Jay Leno's record tonight. Strap in. Here we go. Good evening, Mr. President, or as Paul Ryan refers to you, yet another inner city minority relying on the federal government to feed and house your family. I'm a big fan of President Obama. I think he's one of the all-time great presidents, definitely in the top 50. Please explain that to Jessica Simpson. You're right. That was low. All right. How about the president's performance tonight, everyone? It's amazing that you can still bring it with fresh, hilarious material. And my favorite bit of yours was when you said you'd close the detention facility at Guantanamo Bay. That was a classic. That was hilarious. Hilarious. Still going. I'd like to take a moment to recognize the First Lady, Mrs. Obama. You have been very kind to me and my family, especially when you showed us all how to tear a phone book in half with your bare hands. It was incredible. I'd also like to thank the White House Correspondents Association for having me and for not being able to book Jimmy Fallon. That's true. All right. I know it's been a long night, but I promise that tonight will be both amusing and over quickly, just like Chris Christie's presidential bit. I got a lot of these tonight, so buckle up, Governor Christie. Excuse me. Extender buckle up. All right. I deserve that. I agree on that one. That you're right on. Now, allow me to tell you a little about myself. My name is Joel McHale. I'm on an NBC show called Community. That's exactly what I thought. I also host a show called The Soup, which is on the E! Network. Thank you. To Republicans in attendance, E! Is the channel that your deeply closeted gay son likes to watch. Democrats, it's the same channel that your happy, openly gay son likes to watch. He is also home to the Kardashians, who, believe it or not, are Republicans. And I know that because they're always trying to screw black people. Yep. Now just the men. It's an honor to be here tonight at the Washington Hilton. I'm tingling with excitement, or maybe that's just the bed bugs. I hope you all enjoyed your dinner. The filet tonight was grass-fed beef, freshly dragged off the Clive and Bundy Ranch. The steaks are very tasty once you pull off the tiny white hoods. Oh, see, you like Clive and Bundy. Okay, I get it. All right, great. All right, let it be known. Let the record show. All right, tonight's show is being broadcast on C-SPAN. C-SPAN is, C-SPAN is like one of those Paranormal Activity movies. It's just grainy shots of empty rooms interrupted by images of people you're pretty sure died a few years ago. And stay tuned after the correspondence dinner for an all-new episode of C-SPAN's hit show, So You Think You Can Remain Conscious. Very competitive. This is the 100th year of the White House Correspondents Association. Yes, 100 years ago, CNN was only searching for the Wright brothers' plane. That's true. And the correspondence dinner itself is a tradition dating back to 1920. Back then, this event was only for men. It's true. And there's a plaque in the lobby commemorating this as the location of the very first ever Total Sausage Fest. Hashtag Total Sausage Fest. But that's all changed. Now America is truly a land of diversity. Only here would you find a black president, a soon-to-be Hispanic majority, and all 19 nationalities contained within Arianna Huffington's accent. That was low. It's a genuine thrill to be here in Washington, D.C., the city that started the whole crack-smoking mayor craze. You guys were the first. I hope he's not here tonight. People say that Toronto Mayor Rob Ford is a clumsy mess, but he can't help it. He's a big guy. He's like a bull in a crack pipe shop. Between Rob Ford, Justin Bieber, and Ted Cruz, you just want to tell Canada, hey, hey, relax. We already have a Florida. Ted Cruz proposed a government shutdown to protest the Affordable Care Act, and everyone else in Congress decided to go along with it simply to get some time away from Ted Cruz. The Tea Party is anti-socialism and anti-immigration, so it makes sense that their hero is a Cuban from Canada. Poignant. That one was poignant. The vice president isn't here tonight, not for security reasons. He just thought this event was being held at the Dulles Airport Applebee's. Yes, right now, Joe is elbow deep in jalapeno poppers and talking to a construction cone he thinks is John Boehner. Also true. It's crazy to think that Joe Biden is only one heartbeat away from no one taking him seriously as president. Sorry for that one. Biden will likely be running for president in 2016, saying, and I quote, "There's no obvious reason not to." He talks about his motivation for a presidential run as if he's deciding to finish a meatball hoagie. Hey, it's there, isn't it? Look, all I'm saying, if the bread is toasty and the cheese is warm, I'm going to finish that thing. Jill, bring me my hoagie bib. No, not that one, the fancy one. Hillary Clinton has a lot going for her as a candidate. She has experience, she's a natural leader, and as our first female president, we could pay her 30% less. That's a saving this country could use. Who's with me? Hillary's daughter Chelsea is pregnant, which means in 9 months, we will officially have a sequel to Bad Grandpa. It also raises the question, when the baby is born, do you give Bill Clinton a cigar? You guys sound like you're on a roller coaster right now. There's a heated race on the Republican side. They're all battling to see who will win over the GOP base, and more importantly, who gets to apply turtle wax to Sheldon Adelson's rascal scooter. Jeb Bush says he's thinking about running. Wow. Another Bush might be in the White House. Is it already time for our every 10 years surprise party for Iraq? Yes. As it stands right now, the Republican presidential nominee will either be Jeb Bush, Rand Paul, or a bag of flour with Ronald Reagan's face drawn on it. Bag of flour. All right. People are asking, will Donald Trump run again? And the answer is, does that thing on his head crap in the woods? I actually don't know. I don't know. I don't know if that thing on his head has a digestive system. So, speaking of digestive systems, Chris Christie is here. He's actually here tonight. Wow, sir, you are a glutton for punishment. So here we go. Chris Christie, his administration canceled the train tunnel to Manhattan. They're closing the Pulaski Skyway, and they blocked the George Washington Bridge. Finally, a politician willing to stand up to America's commuters. Governor, do you want bridge jokes or size jokes? Because I got a bunch of both. I could go half and half. I know you like a combo platter. I get that. I'm sorry for that joke, Governor Christie. I didn't know I was going to tell it, but I take full responsibility for it. Whoever wrote it will be fired. But the buck stops here. So I will be a man and own up to it just as soon as I get to the bottom of how it happened, because I was unaware it happened until just now. I'm appointing a blue ribbon commission of me to investigate the joke I just told. And if I find any wrongdoing on my part, I assure you, I will be dealt with. I just looked into it. It turns out I'm not responsible for it. Justice has been served. He's going to kill me. Mr. President, you're no stranger to criticism. Ted Nugent called you a subhuman mongrel. And it's comments like that which really make me question whether we can take the guy who wrote Wang Dang Sweet Poom Tang seriously anymore. Your approval rating has slipped. And even worse, you've only got 2 stars on Yelp. Mitch McConnell said his number one priority was to get the president out of office. So, Mitch, congrats on being just 2 years away from realizing your goal. You did it! Kind of. Mr. President, your harshest critics have compared you to Joseph Stalin, Adolf Hitler, and even Satan. And I just have to say, those comparisons are outrageous. You look way older than those guys. Just because, look, Morgan Freeman has played a president a few times, that doesn't mean you have to look exactly like him, all right? But you are healthy, which is great. Every year, the White House doctor checks the president's colon for polyps and George Clooney's head. It's good to see that White House press secretary and boy detective Jay Carney is here. It's a big night for Jay. I haven't seen him this nervous since the president told him, look, just go out there and tell him the website's broken. They'll understand. That actually probably was a moment. Mr. President, you have to admit, and you already have, the launch of healthcare.gov was a disaster. It was so bad. It was bad. Look, I don't even have an analogy because the website is now the thing people use to describe other bad things. They say stuff like, oh, I shouldn't have eaten that sushi. I was up all night, healthcare.gov. Boy, that latest Johnny Depp movie really healthcare.gov to the box office. The dog's healthcare.gov on it? You can't get healthcare.gov out of shag. But thanks to Obamacare, or as the president refers to it, MeCare, millions of newly insured young Americans can visit a doctor's office and see what a print magazine actually looks like. That's awesome. Now over 8 million people have signed up for Obamacare, which sounds impressive until you realize Ashley Tisdale has 12 million Twitter followers, so that's pretty good. There's a lot going on in the world. Right now, there's a madman who's had plastic surgery running around annexing small countries in Eastern Europe, and all I keep thinking is, what the hell is Bruce Jenner doing in Crimea? Do they even get that show there? But sir, I do think you're making a big mistake with Putin. You have to show a guy like that that you're just as crazy as he is. He invades Crimea, you invade Cancun. Russia takes back the Ukraine, America takes back Texas. Something to think about. Julia Pearson, the new director of the Secret Service, is here tonight. Yeah. Under her leadership, Secret Service agents no longer consort with prostitutes thanks to their new Too Drunk to Make It to the Brothel program. I'm sure she loves that. The Director of National Intelligence, James Clapper, is here. Finally, I can put a face to the mysterious voice clearing its throat on the other end of the phone. It was weird. And, you know, to prepare for tonight, I've been watching a lot of cable news. I am a big fan of that lesbian on MSNBC, Chris Hayes. He's great. Yeah, I agree. MSNBC is a confusing place. I mean, Al Sharpton is their skinny guy. And CNN is desperately searching for something they've been missing for months, their dignity. Totally. That was just that table. At this point, CNN is like the Radio Shack in a sad strip mall. You don't know how it stayed in business this long, you don't know anyone that shops there, and they just fired Piers Morgan. Thank you. Fox News is the highest rated network in cable news. Yeah. I can't believe your table's pushed off that far. And it's all thanks to their key demographic, the corpses of old people who tuned into Fox News and haven't yet been discovered. Former Inside Edition host Bill O'Reilly is not here. He did host that. Bill's got another book coming out soon, so he's making his ghostwriters work around the clock. Bill O'Reilly, Megyn Kelly, and Sean Hannity are the Mount Rushmore of keeping old people angry. This event brings together both Washington and Hollywood. The relationship between Washington and Hollywood has been a long and fruitful one. You give us tax credits for film and television production, and in return, we bring much-needed jobs to hard-working American cities like Vancouver, Toronto, and Vancouver again. Hollywood helps America by projecting a heroic image to the rest of the world. We just released another movie about Captain America, or as he's known in China, Captain Who Owes Us $1.1 trillion. There's a lot of celebrities here tonight. They're the ones that don't look like ghouls. Look around. The cast of Veep is here. That's a series about what would happen if a Seinfeld star actually landed on another good show. I like the new Adventures of Old Christine, I swear. The folks from Duck Dynasty had a very challenging year. The grandfather on that show made homophobic and racist comments. But people are overlooking another issue. He really hates ducks. And Lindsay, if you're here now, you can drop character anytime, man. Oh my. And I'm not going to spoil the shocking twist on House of Cards, But just know that it was so surprising that Nancy Pelosi's face almost changed expression. Did you like that one, Nancy? I can't tell. All right. I'd like to congratulate Jared Leto, who was here tonight. Quote, that hot chick from Dallas Buyers Club. You are in for a very interesting evening. Richard Sherman has already had an impact on tonight's event. He's intercepted all three. So you're right, he's not here to defend himself. Legendary actor Robert De Niro is here tonight, everyone. Now, I don't do a De Niro impression, but I do an impression of Robert De Niro's agent. You ready? Here it is. Ready? Ring, ring. He'll do it. Mr. De Niro, I was in Spy Kids 4, so clearly I'm beyond reproach. So I will see you on the set of Spy Kids 5, I'm sure. Biz Stone, the founder of Twitter, is here. So if any of you congressmen want to cut out the middleman, just show him your penis. Not now. Are you nuts? Okay, those are my warm-up jokes. I'm kidding. I'm kidding. I want to leave you tonight with a bit of a pep talk. America has seen her share of challenges, but as my agents told me when I booked an NBC sitcom, hey, things could be worse. Now, have you watched the news? I mean, not CNN, I mean like the real news. It's pretty bad in other places. By comparison, America is doing great. I mean, this year, after months of heated debate and controversy, we achieved something that will impact the health of millions. We brought back Twinkies. And we're no longer the fattest country in the world. Now Mexico is. But don't worry, we'll be number one again as soon as they all come over here. And what's our biggest concern as Americans? TV show spoilers. In other countries, a spoiler consists of, hey, I haven't been back to the village yet, so don't tell me who survived the drone strike. No spoilers! Sorry about that one. America still has amazing technological innovations. Google Glass has hit the market. Now, just by walking down the street, we'll know exactly who to punch in the face. In America, we see gluten and peanuts as threats to our kids. In other countries, gluten and peanut are the nicknames of warlords who have child armies, so we're better. America is doing just fine, guys. How do I know that? Because we're making a fourth movie about trucks that turn into giant robots. And why are they making a Transformers 4? Because there's still so much story left to tell. So chin up, everyone. This country is still number one in the all-important categories of cream-filled pastries, face computers, and robot trucks. Education, the economy, and the environment? Hey, we'll get them next time. And here's why America is the best country in the world. A guy like me can stand before the president, the press, and Patrick Duffy and tell jokes without severe repercussions. And instead of being shipped off to a gulag, I'm going to the Vanity Fair after party. That's right. This is America where everyone can be a Pussy Riot. This is one of the coolest things that has ever happened to me ever in my entire life. Thank you, Mr. President. Thank you, Mrs. Obama. And thank you, White House Correspondents' Dinner. And thank you, C-SPAN viewer. Good night, everybody. Thank you. All right.
Thank you.
Now, to bring our evening to a close, I'd like you all to remain here for a moment or two while Christy Parsons, our next president, escorts President Mrs. Obama from our hall. Thank you.
Life is hard enough without having to worry about how materialism keeps us from having spiritual experiences. These experiences, outside of the realm of traditional religion, are the basis of a new book called The Quest for Gnosis, exploring the unifying ecstatic states we all experience. The author, Gabriel Roberts, is a former evangelical Christian and theological scholar. He joined me earlier today to discuss his book, which was just released today. I first asked him what gnosis means in the context of what he's presenting in his book.
I'm primarily trying to show people that gnosis is an experience-based mystical knowledge. It means that we're often in Western culture and in the media as well, we're told what to think, we're told what to feel, and we're told to take someone else's word for it. Gnosis, by definition, the ancient Greek definition, is experiential knowledge. It means that you have to go through your own process. You have to do the thing in order to yield the benefits of that experience. And once you do that, it changes the nature of your belief from something that is sort of a blind faith into something that's more of a practical knowledge and understanding of the world and even mystical states.
I wanted to quickly explore psychedelics. I know MAPS has done groundbreaking research. I know that psychedelics helped you on your journey into mysticism. Why do you think that there's still such a taboo topic in the country today?
Well, I would say that Graham Hancock is one of the writers who's also in the book. He's a best-selling author of Fingerprints of the Gods and the book Supernatural. And in it, he discusses, and also in my book, he discusses this fear of, allowing people to have autonomy over their own mind. And his argument would be that if we can't have control over our own mind, then what autonomy do we actually have? When we're talking about doing our own thing, Terence McKenna, the great writer, said that society as a whole might not want us to experience psychedelic experience because it might give us funny ideas. And so we don't want to have people running around having new ideas. That would be bad. It's much easier to just keep things as they are and keep a structure that keeps people thinking the traditional thoughts, the things that have worked for everybody else for a really long time. But in reality, I don't think that they have worked. And if we look into our distant past, as Graham Hancock would also point out in his book Supernatural, you find that this has been a part of the human spiritual experience and very well may have been the birthplace of spirituality. Mm-hmm. The psychedelic experience is integral to a spiritual experience in many ways.
You take into account, you mentioned logic before, I wanted to explore that a little bit, the possibility that human understanding and belief is always changing. So where does rationality and following our logical mind fit into the quest of gnosis?
Well, I think that the biggest thing to recognize is that we do live in a consensus reality. If you drive a car off of a cliff, it will fly off the cliff and it will crash. There is a consensus reality. However, we also understand that the way that we perceive the world is our own kind of custom-made reality. It's what Robert Anton Wilson, the author, called reality tunnels. And each of us builds those things upon, you guessed it, our experience. And when we limit our experience because of fear or because of what someone else tells us, we limit ourselves to having that broader perspective. So actually, logic would tell us that there's a lot less that is static. There, in fact, everything is moving and changing. And if that is the case, then the logical thing to do is to take each experience and measure it against our own logical process, against what we already know and perceive, and to build upon that. Once we have things that are fairly firm as far as concepts, we can build upon that with a fair amount of understanding and confidence that we're moving along the right path.
Amazing that we don't really learn how to think. in school, you know, the trivium, kind of just these very basic concepts of how to process knowledge and expand on that and expand on that. It's really, really amazing. Gabriel, you know, we live in a non-secular world, of course, where 8 out of 10 people subscribe to some sort of religious ideology. Do traditional religious views help or impede achieving the sort of enlightenment that you're describing?
Well, I think that one of the most interesting things that has occurred is that each religious system, and it goes down to every single individual sect within a religious structure, each one uses gnosis, uses this this kind of understanding, and even these ecstatic states that are Gnostic ecstatic states, and then they appropriate them. They said, well, ours is the only real one. Ours is the only true one. When in reality, this common thread that I'm talking about runs throughout all of these religions, and they're all using them as a proof text for their own individual religion. But in fact, this state is a proof text that we have a uniting factor occurring, that we have something that's going on that's happening to all of us, whether we are in an extreme religious situation, or whether we are, an atheist taking a nature walk, we can be experiencing the precise same thing. So gnosis is something that brings us together rather than tears us apart. Traditional religions need to make money just like everybody else does. And as, you know, little mini corporations of their own, they have their own, and they have to do what they got to do to make it look like they're the best. It's like branding, essentially.
Right. Right, it's about finding a common thread that exists within us all. Gabriel, thank you so much. Gabriel Roberts, author, The Quest for Gnosis. Everyone check it out. Contributor to disinfo.com and realitysandwich.com. Appreciate you coming on. Alex and Allison Gray are two of the most influential and radical artists of the last 30 years. Their psychedelic, transformative, and visionary work has been showcased all over the world. It's even featured as album art for bands like Nirvana, the Beastie Boys, and Tool. Alex is probably best known for his depiction of translucent and anatomically correct human bodies that force the viewer to examine the role of human spirituality and higher consciousness. But along with their paintings, the Grays also engage in performance art, sculpture, and installation art. And perhaps the most famous collaborative piece between them is the Chapel of Sacred Mirrors, a trans-denominational church featuring a series of Alex's paintings that has been lauded as one of the most important works of spiritual and transcendental art in the world. The Grays have also had an extraordinary influence on my artistic expression, which is why it's an absolute honor to have them on the show today. Alex, Allison, thank you so much for joining me.
Hi, Abby.
Alex, you're
thanks for having us.
Of course. Alex, you're a self-described visionary artist and often speak about your art as a way for people to develop their inner sight. How would you say that your art facilitates that development?
Well, when people turn within and experience the creative, visionary imagination and see it is another world and another dimension, and they recognize the importance of this dimension, then they want to translate it somehow. And I think it's a basic human motivation. And so seeing anyone do it authentically from some kind of soul intuition is inspiration for any of us to pick up a pencil or whatever kind of creative tool we like to use and speak the truth. Truth, goodness, beauty, all of these work together to find an ideal expression through each of us.
Indeed. And one of the most interesting aspects of your art is the anatomically correct depiction of inner body systems. You spent 5 years studying anatomy at Harvard. Why is scientific accuracy so important to your vision, Alex?
Well, I think that science is the razor by which we measure the truth. And so my body's, rather than focus on one gender or race, are looking for a universal kind of expression. And so the sort of skeletal and anatomical figure is a scientifically, medically defined human being, and it's universal. And so that's the aspiration, is to find what unites us.
Absolutely. Allison, probably the most famous project that you and Alex have collaborated on is the Chapel of Sacred Mirrors. Can you talk about how the vision for the church came about and what ideals the chapel promotes?
The vision for the Chapel of Sacred Mirrors occurred on our first experience, our first journey using the substance MDMA. And we were lying on our bed and we were, our blindfolds were on. And coming out of that experience, we both had seen the Chapel of Sacred Mirrors. And we weren't talking about it. It was a simultaneous vision. And so since 1985, when that happened, we have been on a very interesting path toward how do two artists build a chapel. And that's the story. I mean, the mission of the Chapel of Sacred Mirrors is to build an enduring temple of art to inspire a global community. I mean, it's really about the building of a temple to bring together a community that is that so loves each other and so loves the community itself that they want to build a temple.
It's beautiful, beautiful, Allison. And Alex, let's talk about your latest project, Entheon, which is an incredible new building that will feature your artwork. What do you hope to achieve with the newest installation here?
Well, this will be a sanctuary of visionary art. Entheon means a place to discover the God within. And so it will feature artwork through the international visionary art movement. There's many young artists alive today that are doing extraordinary works. And it's a history of visionary art that is here to serve the awakening, I think, planetary civilization. I think that that is what is next in human experience, is understanding that we're one human family and that we have to work on saving the mother planet. Really, that's what our quest should be about, and not wars between each other.
Absolutely. The revolution of consciousness, I can't think of another artist that depicts this as well as both of you. Allison, you and Alex have collaborated on artwork and life for nearly four decades. I mean, I think what's so inspiring more than anything is the strong bond and spiritual relationship that you guys have held. How have you managed to keep that so strong?
Well, I think these simultaneous visions have been amazing. I think it's our spiritual life, really, that keeps us together in our spiritual life. I grew up Jewish, Alex grew up Christian, but our spiritual life has been revolutionized by psychedelics. And so we find that that's true for a lot of people and communities gathered that feel this opening to spirit through the use of these, what we call sacraments, what we think of as sacraments, and to use them in a sacramental setting. It's science now. I mean, Johns Hopkins has proved it, and it's science. It can cause mystical experiences, and people have them, and they want to gather together around that. So that's been, I think, the glue to our relationship, and having a project together, and many projects, a lifetime together. We share a studio for 38 years, so we're together in the studio all the time. We're always looking at each other's work, and we've influenced each other's work more than anyone or anything ever could.
Amazing. Alex, you often feature religious figures in your work. She just mentioned growing up Jewish, growing up Christian, such as Buddha, Jesus. How does organized religion fit into your notion of spirituality?
Well, I think that humanity is evolving through various waves of consciousness and evolution. So each religion sort of emerges at its proper phase. And so now we have a multiplicity of many different approaches to arrive at the divine. And we like to think in a way that that religion is a united human expression. And by looking at what unites it, such as the arts, creativity runs through all the world religions. We wouldn't know of their stories or see their architecture or art and things like that. So creativity is something that runs through all of them. So we start to think of creativity as a trans-denominational kind of religious orientation or spiritual practice. So and many artists talk about when they are doing their artwork, that's when they're in contact with this creative flow. This creative flow is none other than the creator working through us.
Yeah.
So that's our quest, to provide a place for that realization. We don't advocate the use of these sacraments, and certainly don't do them at our church. It is a current struggle, I think, that the sciences and the arts are trying to find a proper context for these heart-opening sacraments in our evolving society.
Yeah, and Alex, speaking of spiritual depictions, I can't help but ask you about the famous painting of Barack Obama in 2008. It took me by surprise, just because I'm such a huge fan, and you know, I just wanted to see personally what you were trying to express with the painting. And do you think the president has lived up to your portrayal of him here?
Well, I have to say, the painting was done prior to the election. This was back in 2008. And there was McCain versus Barack Obama. And I was at a tattoo convention, and I thought, let's start some conversations. Because of those two candidates, that was the one I would go with. And so I've appreciated having a president who can think on his feet and who's you know, whip smart and has made some advances in the health care and also in the gay rights and things like that. I think this is really actually pretty important stuff. But there's been so many ways that I've been disappointed. So, you know, I've gotten a lot of egg on my face for doing this and creating a kind of unrealistic ideal for anyone to live up to. But I love to see the best in people. And at that time, prior to the election, he was the first person, I think, to have been embraced by the world. And certainly in, you know, in relation to his predecessor, he was a much hoped for kind of transition. So it was on that ride of enthusiasm that many artists, not just mm-hmm. myself, but actually dozens and dozens of artists prior to the election made art about Barack Obama. And that's unprecedented.
And you made him with a third eye.
I did.
That was you.
Yeah.
Well, I totally hear what you're saying. You know, and that's what's so amazing about your art, is that you're putting up this ideal that you want to see be achieved. It's not that you're reflecting something that already is. It's that this is the universal language that we can all hope to achieve, gather together, and put our collective consciousness together to achieve. And Alex, I know that you've served on the board of the Center for Cognitive Liberty and Ethics. Allison, I wanted to go to you and just talk about the notion of cognitive liberty. Why is that so important? We have about a minute left, by the way.
Well, I really want to give it over to Alex. He is the great spokesman
sure.
for cognitive liberty. Let's hear what you have to say. Civil liberty.
Look, the freer that our minds are, the more imagination we can put at the disposal of finding a way to get along and make something beautiful together as a human race. What I think is important now is to reclaim our hearts, our compassion for ourselves and for our mates and for the world, for our communities. Look for ways that we can put peace out in the world. That's why we make art. We think art is the opposite of war. We think that artists, you know, wage peace.
Absolutely.
And so that is our quest.
You guys are both beautiful people, huge inspirations to millions of people around the world. Thank you so much, Alex and Allison Gray. A true pleasure to have
both
of you.
Thank you, Abby.
Thank you, Abby.
That's our show, you guys. Join me again tomorrow when I break the set all over again.
People. Welcome to the Kaiser Report. I'm Max Kaiser. Now, according to the book
Rubicon, the last years of the Roman Republic, it was an article of faith to the Romans that they were the most morally upright people. Hence the Romans' concern to refute all charges of bullying and to insist that they had won their empire purely in self-defense. This sounds familiar, Stacy.
Max, we are looking upon an empire across the world right now called the United States Empire. However, it was won purely for humanitarian reasons. It was there. All these 190 bases around the world are just to help the people. So we're going to look at first a series of three headlines just from the past 3 weeks relating to Chuck Hagel, the Secretary of Defense. During Southeast Asia trip, Chuck Hagel stresses humanitarian aid coordination. So they talk about, in particular, for example, the U.S. Marines. They brought rice to the Filipinos after a recent major typhoon. And this is why the Asia pivot. They're sending two-thirds of the U.S. naval fleet over to Southeast Asia for humanitarian reasons.
Well, I mean, this is fascinating to watch because, as we point out, the analogy to the collapse of the Roman Empire is apt. And now we have the collapse of the American Empire. And you see people like Chuck Hagel scrambling around the world to convince everybody that they're there for humanitarian reasons. And everyone knows that has access to a TV or an internet that that's nonsense, that Hagel is just trying to wage a massive propaganda effort to get his subjects in these countries that America dominates ruthlessly to believe and to accept their occupation, and they're not having any of it.
It seems, as you quoted in the beginning, that the Romans were forced to deny that they were bullying, so it seems that there were some alternative media at the time who said, oh, you Romans are just bullying. They were probably accused of being anti-Roman, and the Romans themselves were saying, we got this empire of self-defense. Here's another headline from their own backyard in America. Hagel, Guatemalan leaders visit troop humanitarian projects. On his first visit to Guatemala as U.S. Defense Secretary, Chuck Hagel visited a small town that is the most recent site of humanitarian projects that U.S. and Guatemalan troops work side by side to complete. Again, here's, you know, the U.S. budget officially for the Pentagon is $600 billion a year. If you add in the NSA and the CIA and the FBI and the DIA and all these various intelligence agencies, it's closer to $1 trillion a year.
Chuck Hagel works with vicious dictators, and I'm sure very soon we'll see images of Chuck with a little kid on his knee bouncing him, like those famous photos of Saddam Hussein or other dictators throughout history. I think Hitler, there's a photo of Hitler also. They have a nice bouncing kid on their knee, feeding them a lollipop. This is how we do it in the humane, beautiful Elysian fields and purple mountains of America. And it just gets more propagandistically unacceptable.
So $1 trillion per year for humanitarian missions, they claim, around the world. A lot of people end up dead. Those are just, you know, it hurts the empire, I'm sure, more than it hurts the people who were killed. And then here's finally another headline. Same 2 weeks. These are the last 3 weeks, 2 weeks of headlines. Chuck Hagel given a look at Atlas, DARPA's humanitarian robot. U.S. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel got a firsthand look at a life-size robot that resembles Hollywood's Terminator, the latest experiment by the Pentagon's high-tech researchers. But unlike the movie version, the hulking Atlas was designed not as a warrior, but as a humanitarian machine that would rescue victims in the rubble of a natural disaster, officials said. So with their robots, with their actions around the world, it might look like the Terminator. Those weaponry and those ships and those drones and everything that goes with it might look scary, but they're all humanitarian.
Yeah, what's that phrase? The beatings will continue until morale improves. So there's Chuck Hagel with his drones, his robots, his financial oppression, really bringing that humanitarian cause like they did so successfully in Libya, Iraq, Afghanistan, Vietnam, or even Detroit for that matter. These people are kleptomaniacs and shouldn't be as trusted as far as you can throw them. Or if you get a chance, throw up on them. Make sure that Hagel is in the right in the stream of a maybe a projectile vomit to let people know how they feel about him, really.
So I want to look at the front page of the Financial Times, which has a shocking headline here. China to overtake U.S. economy this year.
You know, you've got your follow-up here, because this humanitarian Chuck Hagel roadshow of terror, which he calls the humanitarianism, is like Charles Manson on an international roadshow of terror and abuse. So here he is, Chuck Hagel, the new Charles Manson. And he's like, okay, this is what it's all tied to, that China is now officially their worst fears. Hillary Clinton's worst fear, William Crystal, bloody William Crystal, the neocon psychopath from Washington. This is his worst fear. This is the project for a new American century. This is their worst fear, that China is overtaking the U.S. They've been talking about it for 20 years. Their solution was to bomb the bejesus out of everybody to try to, wait a minute, don't progress. We want to be the number one. They screwed up.
Yes. Well, you bring up the policy for a new American century, and if you go back and look at it, just Google it, anybody go out there, it's Donald Rumsfeld, Dick Cheney, Jeb Bush, who was supposed to be president, not George Bush, that was accidental. So here we had a group of guys who were very well connected and did run the government that bombed Iraq. What they were saying in their own policies was that we need to stop China from rising. However, it's happened sooner than everybody expected. As you can see from the chart, you can see this is China is the red line, of course. America is the blue line, and China's passing it. So that's real GDP at purchasing power parity, and this comes from the World Bank. The U.S. is on the brink of losing the status as the world's largest economy and is likely to slip behind China later this year, sooner than anticipated.
It's amazing that you can still bring it with fresh, hilarious material. And my my favorite bit of yours was when you said you'd close the detention facility at Guantanamo Bay. That was a classic. That was hilarious, hilarious. Still going. I'd like to take a moment to recognize the First Lady, Mrs. Obama. You have been very kind to me.
Global leader since overtaking the UK in 1872. Most economists previously thought China would pull ahead in 2019. So they based this rather than on exchange rates, but on purchasing power parity. So to see what the real purchasing power is of the economy and the participants in that local economy.
Right. Well, the U.S. strategy to deal with all this has been horribly misguided. And the way that the U.S. would have stayed number one is if they could have resisted this idea from corporations to balkanize the internet, to shut down the internet, to make it controlled by Hollywood, to turn it into HBO, home box office, pay-per-view. If they had allowed the internet to be net neutrality to exist, end-to-end freedom, then you would have had a boomlet of innovation and wealth creation distributed to the hamlets and villages throughout the United States and around the world, bringing that message of technological innovation that made the U.S., you know, the previous empire holder in the U.S. But instead they kowtowed to the lobbyists from Hollywood, the Motion Picture Association of America. The internet's been essentially shut down to protect the Hollywood industry. And as a result, now China is leapfrogging past the U.S. So the strategy of bombing nations was the wrong strategy. It didn't work. Those people are tyrannical fools. The strategy of an open internet would have worked, as many have argued, but they didn't choose that path. And now they're going to go down the slippery slope into second-class world status, and to hell with them.
Well, speaking of Hollywood, actually, in the past week, they're getting ready for Cannes. The Cannes Film Festival is about to start. They were very vocal. They're now saying, hello, U.S., stop this this upcoming war with Russia, because Russia is a bigger film market than Ukraine. Ukraine, we get $0. Russia, we get many dollars. We want to do deals. All of our Russians are pulling out of our deals down in Cannes. The other thing that we saw is bondholders. Fitch said that bondholders are telling the U.S. government, back off, dudes, because we're going to get hit whacked severely if you actually touch any company in Russia that is actually means anything. So just go for the small fry like you do in the rest of the world. you know, attack Libya, attack, you know, little nations, but just leave the big stuff alone.
Russia's a huge consumer market, like Liam Halligan pointed out on this show. It's the biggest consumer country, really, in Europe, if you want to look at it in those terms. But this is a war between the defense industry that loves to send drones down and blow people up needlessly versus the bond market and the copyright industry represented by Hollywood interests. So Hollywood and the bond market is saying, wait a minute, this incursion into Russia, I mean, let's put it the way it should be stated. I mean, the U.S. is invading Russia, essentially. They're saying that Russia does not have the right for self-determination. So they're inching their way into Russia through Ukraine. I mean, that's what's going on here. The U.S. wants to grab Russia, China, Iran. They don't want these three countries to have a central bank. They don't want them to have self-determination. They don't want them to have an economy outside of the Hollywood cartel and outside of their total fiat currency nightmarish control. And they're saying, what the frick, man? We don't want to be part of that nonsense. So now we've got this standoff.
You speak of control, and the article in the Financial Times does bring that up. The findings will intensify arguments about control over global international organizations such as the World Bank and IMF, which are out of line with the balance of global economic power. So, of course, those organizations were sustained and built and created in order to sustain U.S. power. Now that's slipping away. People are saying, hey, where's our due? Even, by the way, I noticed while I was holding this up, if you look at the top of the page, Americans abroad, why tax rules are encouraging basically expatriation. Americans are fleeing because they don't want to finance all those humanitarian missions that cost $1 trillion a year for those humanitarian missions.
Again, to use the Roman Empire analogy, you've got a country that is spending way too much on protecting far-flung borders that they don't have any interest in protecting at this point. It's purely to feed the defense industry and those folks in Washington. You know, the richest zip codes in America are in Washington, where they've got the defense industry, those contractors, the mercenaries that they send out. That's where all the money is. And those people, unfortunately, are throwing the country under the bus so that they can continue to rentier, seek and scalp and gorge their way, their money on sending drones into these countries, killing kids for a few bucks. That's what Obama administration was remembered for. Drones for death for Pentagon bonuses. That's what his administration will be remembered for. All right, well, we got to go, Stacey.
See you later, Max.
Stay tuned for the second half. A whole lot more. Welcome back to the Kaiser Report. I'm Max Kaiser. Time now to turn to Nafiz Ahmad, author of The Crisis of Civilization, and he's a columnist at The Guardian newspaper. Welcome back to the Kaiser Report.
Thanks for having me on again.
All right, let's talk about everyone's favorite villain, Tony Blair. Is smokescreen to defend blood for oil. Speak.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think a lot of us were quite shocked, I think, when Tony Blair did his speech on essentially what his vision was for the Middle East once again. You know, there was one point where he said his first major reason to stay involved in the Middle East, yes, he said, was oil. Western economies are still heavily dependent on oil. This is not going to change anytime soon, he said. So we're going to have to, you know, do something about that.
Okay, so this sounds like a complete 180-degree reversal from the lead-up to the war in Iraq, where, of course, it was sacrilege to suggest that it was blood for oil, that the UK was bringing freedom and democracy to these oppressed people. Now he's talking about nothing but oil.
Well, I mean, what's interesting is that he talks a lot about democracy, and we need to basically defend freedom and stop the extremists from destroying us. But it was his first reason. His first reason was oil. His second reason was, I think, our relationship with Israel. The third reason was to do with defending freedom and things like that. And I can't remember what the fourth reason was, but they're all very interconnected. And what was interesting was the way he then followed through with that in terms of, okay, so we defend freedom by maintaining good relationships with the Gulf regimes, which are pursuing reforms, which is like, okay, the Saudis and Qatar, there's no real reform happening there. He was like, we have to really support the new regime in Sisi, which has slaughtered, you know, thousands of people in the streets, unprecedented, even worse than anything that Mubarak has done. is one of the biggest massacres in the history of Egypt. And he's basically saying, you know, then, and they've just condemned 700 Muslim Brotherhood activists to death sentence, you know, in these kind of phony trials where everyone knows there's no due process. You know, the Muslim Brotherhood is not like, no one's going to say it's the wonderful organization. But at the end of the day, it did win elections.
Well, we should mention that Blair has made millions on this exploitation of these people that he had a hand in killing.
Absolutely.
So there's a genocide in Iraq, a million people slaughtered by the Lancet, had an estimate of upwards to a million people massacred. Tony Blair, the dodgy dossier, the false pretense to go to Iraq, the mass slaughter of Iraqis, and he's made millions of pounds. I want to ask you about something. Talk about Tony Blair versus John Kerry, because John Kerry, Secretary of State, he's finding it very frustrating because every time he opens his mouth, the global media and the social media and this show points out that he sounds like a throwback from the old Cold War days, or he's behind what we call the CNN curtain, that he lives in an echo chamber, a bubble. He really, and he expresses his frustration. He talks about RT. So does Hillary Clinton, talks about RT, this network, about how they can't seem to get their message through because everyone's watching RT. But Tony Blair, he's part of that cadre of war profiteers that is trying to milk their slaughter, to put it one way. Does he just have no shame? Is he psychologically impaired? How does he deal with the fact that everyone sees him now as a rampant opportunistic ghoul?
Well, who knows? I mean, I think what's interesting about Blair and the way he's received by the so-called mainstream media is that, and then this is what I found quite shocking really as well, is that despite his track record, which I think is very well documented now to the point that it's almost common knowledge, his speech was given very, very good publicity overall. I mean, my article, there were a handful of other articles in the kind of slightly more liberal lefty media that, you know, criticized him or called him to account. But the overwhelming response of the news media was, hey, look at this great speech. We should actually take it seriously. He's raising some important issues. And interestingly, as you said, no one asked a simple question. Well, this is the man that has explicitly and repeatedly denied that oil has anything to do with our role in the Middle East. And is, even in fact, a year ago when he was on Newsnight, and now is openly saying quite clearly that actually it's very central to our reasons for being in the Middle East. So I think there's no coincidence that, you know, he's an advisor at JP Morgan. JP Morgan's clients, a Guardian investigation showed actually that his many of JP Morgan's clients benefited from Blair's operations in Israel-Palestine, where he was effectively lobbying for oil and gas interests.
Okay, you mentioned that mainstream media gave him a somewhat positive review, but this is behind what I call the CNN curtain, where those who are benefiting from this will listen to that and it'll validate their actions. But the other vast majority of the globe now realizes that if you see Tony Blair enter your neighborhood, you know, what's the expression about the Buddha? I don't want to say it on this show because it would be cut, but I won't say it. But you look it up on if you see the Buddha on the road, just substitute if you see Tony Blair on the road, and you'll know where I'm getting at. Okay, now what is this phrase that you have in a recent piece? Capitalism's unspoken holocaust. What is it?
Well, that's I mentioned this actually in the piece about Tony Blair, which is, you know, he kind of gives forth this idea of this global economy, which of capitalism, which has brought so much brilliance, freedom, and profits for, you know, which trickle down to everybody and everyone's happy. And then, of course, there's the evil, you know, extremists, you know, on the other side who are out to stop this. And of course, most of us who've done any bit of reading or any aware of history know that since 1945 until today, we've had over 70 plus military interventions. And that has been what has expanded capitalism. Capitalism didn't expand through this automatic economic process of just, whoopee-woo, let's just enter these markets and everything's going to be happy. It was done forcibly by forcibly transforming markets to ensure that the right kinds of conditions were there for capital penetration to take place. And that was how capitalism expanded across the former colonies, if you like. And that created a huge amount of bloodshed. And the figures that I have from very, very good academic sources are looking at up to about 13 to 14 million people died directly as a consequence of these wars and interventions. And that's one estimate by a guy, J.W. Smith, an American economist. And he also says countless hundreds of millions from the indirect consequences, the structural consequences in terms of destroying people's economies, livelihoods, that kind of thing.
All right, let me talk about this word Holocaust, because obviously it's a very powerful word that conjures up enormous emotional reaction. But the fact is that the Holocaust people remember from the last century was, in fact, geared toward business interests. In other words, the economy of Germany, as it relates to the Holocaust at that time, it was a profit center.
Yeah.
And capitalism had turned into a machine that used human beings essentially as the raw material to generate the cash to get that war machine going. So there was an economic justification for it.
Yeah.
And so now what you're suggesting here with your phrase capitalism's unspoken Holocaust is that once again we're at a stage in capitalism's cycle, the lifespan, where the destruction, the wholesale genocide and Holocaust of human beings is at the root of powering the economic growth that we see in the U.S. and in the U.K., is that a fair statement?
I think it is fair. I mean, I think it would be naive to basically somehow try to separate out the dark side of capitalism in this sense from the so-called light side of capitalism. I mean, there's no doubt, yes, you know, we've had technological developments, we've had modern medicine, we've had all sorts of great things, but it has all come at a cost. And that's why you have people like Blair, who see it as their job to go out and do PR for this machine in order to convince people that, no, you should be scared. We need to have fear-mongering in order to basically keep this machine going, to continue to justify that constant posture of military intervention in order to keep control of different distant markets, to deal with instabilities that are arising, or even develop insurgencies with states that are not integrating into the global system.
Let me throw another contentious word out there, apartheid, because John Kerry, Secretary of State, recently said what's going on between Israel and Palestine is an apartheid state. And the comment was made that you can talk about peace process all you want, but as long as Israel keeps building settlements there, and they're building settlements at a breakneck speed, that is completely anathema to any concept of any peace process. So, and of course, Blair is part of the quartet that is there to bring peace. So my question is he lying through his teeth and that he's not there to bring peace at all? He's using his position as a former prime minister to rape these poor people financially, to gain personal aggrandizement, to build one of his seven huge palatial homes around the world. And is he just there basically marauding, kind of conquering psychopath who just uses his winnings from the Iraq war genocide to further his financial gains again?
Well, you know, one can only judge.
Can I get a job at The Guardian, by the way? I mean, I'm turning out these phrases like they're coming at me like water, man. I should be writing for that paper.
Yeah, I agree. You know, I think you've nailed it. I mean, I think if you know, you judge a person by their actions, you can't really do much more than that. And all you've actually done just now, Max, is actually just describe precisely what he's actually doing. So it's difficult to look at that. You know, he has basically been profiteering on the basis of his involvement in Israel-Palestine. You know, he hasn't done, I mean, people have actually, there was actually a paper, an article in the Jerusalem Post the other day asking, what is Blair doing in the Middle East? And, you know, he doesn't seem to be actually very involved very much in the diplomatic negotiations. He's involved in all of this other stuff, you know, making money.
Doing deals.
Yeah, absolutely, doing deals. And he's made a huge amount of money from this. So that's also what's rather shocking about this, really, is that more than anyone in the public eye, he's not only been at the forefront of legitimizing and pushing forward these kind of wars, he's actually at the forefront of profiteering from them personally.
I want to continue, Nafees, because we didn't get a chance to talk about a couple of things. Now, at the moment, the U.S. has sent troops to Eastern Europe and is engaged in an Asia pivot, diverting the U.S. naval capacity toward China. Are these humanitarian in nature, as Chuck Hagel claims, or does this have to be something more with capitalism, what's going on?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think to answer that question, you might want to have a look, for example, at actual strategic planning documents to see, well, what are U.S. interests in Eastern Europe from a military perspective, from an economic perspective? What are the issues that they think are most prominent? And, you know, from those documents, I've not seen the word humanitarian used once. So this is a new thing, really, Chuck Hagel's effort to kind of create some kind of legitimization smokescreen. And what they do talk about are really very simple geopolitical issues, which are the same issues that have always heavily dominated the way states think about these kind of things. And for the US, it's very much to do with energy geopolitics, sidelining Russia's influence over energy corridors, but also sidelining Russia's general regional influence, ensuring that many of these Eastern European countries operate on a basis of free markets, open up their economies to foreign investors, hopefully European and American and British investors. So this is very much the traditional kinds of things. And again, of course, you know, the euphemism of this is about freedom and humanitarianism, where humanitarianism really here effectively is the same thing as freedom in the sense of free markets.
All right, now, please, we got to cut it off there. Thanks again for being on the Kaiser Report.
Thank you.
And that's going to do it for this edition of the Kaiser Report with me, Max Kaiser, and Stacey Herbert. I'd like to thank our guest, Afiz Ahmad. If you'd like to get in touch, tweet us at Kaiser Report. Until next time, bye, y'all.
Hey, everybody. Wow, that was good. I just wanted to say when there was that joke that he was trying to say that it was a joke that everybody was going to get out of Guantanamo Bay, I don't know if you heard it, but Barack Obama he took it well, but he said, don't worry, be happy. That's what he said. In other words, this is tied in with the characters that have kept that from happening. So he's going to do something about it here in the not too distant future. And also, I'm just going to say this article that I kind of just gave the headliner to a while back, it just says exclusive New York judge is largest bankruptcy case in largest bankruptcy case in history, receives IRS and SEC whistleblower filing. And just read a little bit of it so that you know what it's being talked about. Oh, Rama's got something pulled up here too. That's only, let me just read this little first paragraph and then you can push. That's only 2 minutes. Yeah, Rana. Okay, so the Internal Revenue Service and Securities Exchange Commission received the same package today. It goes back to April 24th, but that's not like in the ancient past here. Among its contents is Morse's whistleblower submission of the IRS Form 211, an application for award for original information, and the SEC Form TCR Section TIP, complaint or referral accompanied by voluminous supporting documentation. These federal agencies are mandated to investigate allegations of corruption and fraud. The 51 bankrupt residential mortgage companies are directly or indirectly owned by Residential Capital, also known as ResCap. Morse, a commissioned officer, was honorably discharged from the United States Air Force and the United States Navy as an F-4 Phantom fighter pilot. He was one of the initial people who uncovered and successfully prosecuted a federal fraud case regarding the savings and loans debacle in the late 1980s. Like millions of Americans, Morris believed when he refinanced his home mortgage in 2008 that it was legitimate, yet found out otherwise when he discovered that his chain of title had been broken by Mortgage Electronic Registration Systems, Inc., or MERS, M-E-R-S. That's the name of a virus, boy. That's a virus, all right. That's unbelievable. His home in Texas was not and is not in foreclosure. He has never been late or missed a mortgage payment. According to New York bankruptcy court records, as of March 2012, at stake are over 2.4 million mortgages and residential mortgage-backed securities, or RMBS, representing over 6.2 million Americans, according to U.S. Census statistics. The value of this bankruptcy case as of today is well over $400 billion, making it the largest bankruptcy in history. There has been virtually no press coverage of this bankruptcy that affects the entire United States economy, millions of homeowners and nations who purchased RMBS securities. It far exceeds in dollar volume and social impact the General Motors bankruptcy, which garnered front page media coverage for months. 68% of these mortgages in this New York bankruptcy are either owned, insured, or guaranteed by government-sponsored enterprises, GSEs, of Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and Ginnie Mae. Purportedly, a significant number of the mortgages are owned by RMBS trusts. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are in conservatorship or bankruptcy. Their conservator is the United States Federal Housing Finance Agency, FHFA, a famous, lovely thing. $45 billion is guaranteed by Ginnie Mae. It appears this single bankruptcy represents at least 3% of all active U.S. residential mortgages. Morris's whistleblower filing package that was received by Judge Glenn today includes his 279-page jurat affidavit in support of IRS Form 211 and SEC Form TCR. His jurat affidavit is supported by 11,000 pages of corroborated, publicly sourced, and court-admissible evidence related to the mortgage crisis, the 2008 economic crash, his 2011 Racketeer Influence and Corrupt Organizations Act, RICO civil case addressing his fraudulent mortgage, and the alleged acts of securities fraud, and income tax evasion. Now let's get serious, huh, folks? As a court-designated creditor, Morris has had access to the documents through the official court-ordered website for large bankruptcies. He and his team have scoured through court documents, and to their best knowledge, it appears that these issues have not been introduced or investigated by the bankruptcy court. Additional court docket information is available. And then there's a click there. I will get this up on our website. The next hearing in Judge Glenn's courtroom regarding Morris's case is currently scheduled for May 15th. That's one day after the, the full moon. Yeah. And Buddha's birthday is on the 14th. Yep. It regards his RICO civil case due to a fraudulent residential mortgage on his Texas home, in which he is the sole pro se plaintiff. Morris's RICO civil case is how he became a creditor in his New York bankruptcy case. Under 18 U.S.C. section 1964, private citizens may seek civil damages due to RICO fraud activities. He has been in federal court since April 26, 2011. attempting to get the court to allow the evidence to be brought before a jury of his peers, Morris's whistleblower filing to the IRS and the SEC grew out of his RICO case, which was originally filed in the United States Federal District Court. Eastern District of Texas and is currently on interlocutory appeal in the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. In an exclusive interview with his journalist, when asked what he saw taking place behind the scenes of this mortgage crisis, Morris said, "I see that RICO's fraud enterprise with MERS in the center as being a well-masked, legally controlled, and potentially a judicially assisted resource, land and asset grab from the American people. Just look at the publicly disclosed evidence. Remember, according to the Federal Reserve's own reports," I mean, this is treason when you get down to it. Holy macaroni. Just winding around the road here. "Just look at the publicly disclosed evidence. Remember, according to the Federal Reserve's own reports, the current value of all residential mortgages in the country is estimated to be $13 trillion or so. Compare this number with only the short-term federal debt that now exceeds $17 trillion. That means that the total value of residential mortgages alone represents 76% of the entire national debt. This is very serious, and the stakes are very high. It does not matter. It does not appear that Judge Glenn is aware of the alleged securities fraud, and income tax evasion issues related to a number of the 51 bankruptcy petitioners," Morris added. "As Judge Glenn elects to consider our evidence, he could do nothing, or he could place this bankruptcy hearing in abeyance pending the results of my requested IRS and SEC investigations. As Judge Glenn allows the bankruptcy to proceed, according to the court documents, the Second Amendment amended joint Chapter 11 plan approved on December 13th, 2013, allows for the liquidation of hundreds of billions of dollars worth of homeowners' mortgages to legendary business billionaire magnate, the fourth richest man in the world, according to Forbes, Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway Inc., and Aquin Loan Servicing, LLC. Oh, my God. The bankruptcy terms allows Berkshire Hathaway, and this is all on Warren Buffett's head, woo, and Aquin to purchase over, I'll get through this here, over $400 billion worth of mortgages and RMBS trusts for less than $5 billion. Once these mortgages are sold, Berkshire Hathaway and Aquin will be bankruptcy remote. That means that once the mortgage assets are sold to them, American homeowners like Morris will not be able to obtain, through discovery in judicial proceedings, the documents pertaining to their mortgages to determine as there is an issue with their property's chain of title or verify as there is a free, clear, and legally traceable ownership of their homes. In effect, mortgage records of millions of American homeowners would be destroyed. Last March, Aquin was found guilty of breaking laws in 49 states. In the Los Angeles Times, Scott Record reported, "California victims of alleged foreclosure abuses will get $268 million in relief from the $2.1 billion national settlement with Aquin Financial Corporation, the nation's largest non-bank provider of settlement with the Aquin Financial Corporation, the nation, of mortgage customer service. The announcement also spotlights a growing controversy as major lenders outsource their mortgage servicing operations to Aquin and other firms that specialize in collecting payments, pressuring delinquent borrowers and foreclosing on defaulted mortgages. Berkshire Hathaway and Aquin did not respond to a request for comment for this article. The result of this massive sell-off of mortgages is that the effective destruction, effective This effective destruction of documents could contribute to covering up and making it more difficult to corroborate the alleged acts of securities fraud, and income tax evasion. This is the end game exit strategy and cover up I warned about 4 years ago. Morse explained to this journalist, for obvious reason, it was necessary to ensure that Judge Glenn was made aware of the evidence. Otherwise, he could go down in history as the man who unknowingly destroyed the rights of millions of American homeowners. In October 2010, Morse wrote an article that was well circulated on the internet where he forecasted and warned that this exact set of bankruptcy proceedings and the results would occur and proved to be the endgame exit strategy for those banks and participants like MERS in the RICO fraud enterprise at the heart of the mortgage crisis. Quote, the light speed rate at which this bankruptcy on behalf of the money changers with their Fortune 125 law firms is being pushed through is breathtaking. For the last 3 years, I, as a pro se plaintiff, have been following the rules and have not been able to present this evidence before a jury. Unlike my savings and loan days in the late 80s, where the rule of law still applied in America and the guilty were held accountable, I have witnessed acts of perjury and misrepresentation on behalf of the defendant's attorneys made to the court with no redress or accountability, Morse said. James Kidney, SEC trial attorney, is also concerned about the lack of accountability in the 2008 economic crisis. As Bloomberg News Robert Schmidt recently reported, Kidney warned during his outgoing retirement remarks, the SEC has become an agency that polices the broken windows on the street level and rarely goes to the penthouse floors. On the rare occasions when enforcement does go to the penthouse, good manners and are paramount. Tough enforcement, risky enforcement is subject to extensive negotiation and weakening. Because of the scope and the volume of evidence Morse has uncovered and documented, in addition to the IRS SEC, put a light around this person, I don't want no more dead bodies, the IRS SEC and Judge Glenn, his whistleblower filing was submitted to over 500 other recipients, including President Barack Obama, the Secretary of the Treasury, all Supreme Court justices, and all members of that's a den of iniquity, and the other members of the United States Judicial Branch, chairman of the ranking members of the United States House of Representatives, standing committees, inspectors generals of the numerous federal agencies, G20 summit members, members of the United States Senate. Sounds like a bunch of criminals just about. There's a few good guys in there. Barack Obama's on the good side. And the national and international media, attorneys from the Birmingham, Alabama law firm of Bradley Arndt Bolt Cummings, LLP, and who are representing both the debtors and the creditors in the New York bankruptcy case and the New York law firm of Morrison and Forrester, LLP. According to Morse's whistleblower, Jurat Affidavit, the IRS and the SEC are the last remaining hopes for justice in disclosing the complete and truthful facts regarding this RICO fraud enterprise that is the mortgage crisis and are the federal agencies with the experience, capability, jurisdictional authority, and congressionally mandated tasks of investigating, stopping, and prosecuting fraud. Justice and the rule of law must be maintained in these legal actions or the rights, homesteads, and financial lives of millions of Americans will be destroyed. The results, positive or negative, will directly affect millions of Americans today and in the years to come. Morse's fight is everybody's fight. His legal battle affects millions of American homeowners and beyond. As I have been reviewing the court records, whistleblower filing package, and evidence for weeks, also included within Morse's whistleblower filing is a media query from me in my capacity as a journalist. I have requested that the recipients respond directly so I can report their responses verbatim and in their entirety to preserve the integrity of the IRS and the SEC investigations prompted by Morse's whistleblower filing. Non-responses will be reported as well. This is an exclusive story. Must credit investigative journalist Marinka Pershman. Okay, I got it in there. Okay, Ram. Rama, honey. Rama, darling. Let's play this 2-minute piece. to play this 2-minute piece. Yeah. We got a 2-minute piece here. It's called Message from Mikos, channeled by Mikos, M-I-K-O-S. Tell us who Mikos is, Rama.
He's the librarian in the Portos Logos Library. And he works with Lord Adama.
And what's in the Portos Logos Library?
Millions of copies of Crystal Records.
Okay, so we're just going to hear a 2-minute piece on this now. Okay, everybody, just listen to that. You just turned the sound down.
I did.
Yeah. Okay. No, it went down again. Okay, now.
Okay. Hello, my name is Diane Robbins, and I am talking to you from my home in Mount Shasta, California. This is a message by Mikos from the Library of Portholagos, located in the hollow earth beneath the Aegean Sea. I am very old by definition. I span eons of time in the same body. I have been able to compile Earth's records in the Library of Portholagos, where all Earth's history has been preserved. Our library is immense and holds the records of the universe, not just Earth. I am an ambassador for the whole Earth. I venture out on journeys to other star systems and galaxies and arrange for their records to be transferred to our library here in Portholagos for safekeeping. We house all the records in our universe, so that someday all people everywhere in our universe will be able to come here to peruse their records and learn their wisdom to avert the negative and ensure the positive outcome of all events. This is the purpose of a library. It is to give guidance for the evolution of a society and a planet, so that the people can live and evolve in peace and prosperity. All conceivable situations and answers are found in our library, ready to be assimilated by you. As soon as peace prevails on the surface, we can open our library doors to you and accompany you inside. We long for this day. As we draw closer to our glorious reunion, we send you our everlasting love from below. I am Mikos. For more channeled messages from Mikos, you may visit my website, www.dianerobbins.com.
That was a good hope. Hopeful message. Thank you, Rama. That was short, sweet, and exactly what the doctor ordered here. All this hoopla that's been going on. Okay, let's do a 5-minute briefing here with our sister Dahani. Start this paragraph above. There are these small people, and they lived for we were talking about Yahula, and that these little people, in the Smoky Mountains and South Georgia, the Great Smoky Mountains in South Georgia, when people hear the sound of horses and bells at night, they will say, "There goes Yahula on his rounds." These small people lived for 600 to 1,000 years. Once they bonded with a family, they stay with the medicine people of that family. One of these people was a friend of my grandfather's and helped him find herbs and crystals. And we were just talking to Mikos, and Mikos was just talking to us of this crystal library, just showing the connection here. As my grandfather passed on, this little man became a part of my life. Even now, as I travel around the world, occasionally while sitting in a hotel, I will look up and see him just sitting in a chair looking at me. Ram, you got a Sufi, mm-hmm. Sufi song, right?
I have the Ondar.
Oh, no, a Sufi thing. Oh, oh yeah. Okay. So we take friendships very seriously. They go on for generations. These little people's voices are beautifully melodic. And as they sing together, it is like the sound of fine glass bells. Their drum beat is very, very fast as they play. They are renowned for their understanding of healing herbs and share that wisdom with those who ask. A water drum is a powerful medicine object carved from a tree and then hollowed out. The bottom is solid wood, and the drum is covered with a skin and filled with water. One coaxes pulses of the universe from the vibration of the drum and water. Just as there are small people, there are also giants who walk among us. There is also a group of people we call the immortals. I have met some immortals who looked like older Cherokee people. They were close to 7 feet tall. First they were not there, then they appeared. In other cultures, these beings might be referred to as gods, like those described in Norse and Greek and Roman mythology. To us, they are just another kind of person who shares this dream space of Earth with us. So, these excursions into the woods opened our hearts and minds to the many ways in which all living beings are connected. Some common rhythm drums very far away and holds the beat. Some common rhythm drums very far away and holds the beat to which... Second, go to the next page here. To which we all dance. In a dark night, with the stars shining brightly, one can hear this deep thrumming and the songs of the stars that sustain all the worlds we know. Something else we were taught was how to find our own particular direction. First, we would walk in a very large spiral, turning as we went until the spiral tightened. Then, holding our right hand up and our left hand down, we continued to circle around until we felt a place of greater strength or perception of the vibration of the earth and the sky. We sensed the warm winds and the gentle undulations. The place could be any place. It was more about how we oriented in terms of our place of birth. While standing in this place, we could hear the voices of people all over the world and those who were thinking of us or talking about us. Okay, Commander Don, can you get our sister Rainbird? Commander Don, can you call our sister Rainbird? Do you hear what I hear? Can you hear me? Aloha. You might have to go call because I don't see him answering. Yeah, go call him. Yeah. Where I live now, there is a spot in my house where I can stand and I can hear people in the whole valley talking as well as others far away. This practice is applicable even in this time of telecommunications. While I hear many, very few hear my response unless they are standing in their place. It is as though there were two great vortices that are wide at the end, where one is standing in one space and then narrowing as it goes out. When the other person is standing in their space, the vortex goes out from them, very wide, like a comb. And these two vortices join at their edges. Then one can hear as though standing next to each other. One actually hears more from one ear than the other, as though the person is standing to the right or left. Oh, well, maybe she was gone all day today then.
Yeah.
Okay. This was the first telephone. Yes, okay. One actually hears more from one ear than the other, as though the person is standing to the right or the left. This was the first telephone. It's still the best one. And guess what? It's free. Yeah. I guess that's good enough. All right, Rama, did you find something?
Yeah.
You got a good one?
Yeah. Jalaluddin and Love.
We never played that one before?
I don't remember playing that one.
Okay.
It's 11 minutes.
That's okay. Let's get started.
Okay.
All right, everybody. What a full day.
Ready?
Yeah. Okay. This is on love, everybody. Go to one with words. We want to do this one with words here. Which one? Which one you want?
Okay.
Okay, we do that before?
Yeah, but it's a good one.
Okay, a good one.
Yeah.
You sure it's got words now?
Yeah.
Okay, let's do the one with the words.
Okay, it's coming.
Hopefully.
Oh, that's why.
The whole impulse to move out, to go out, is one of the great human activities, isn't it? And that surely has a lot of longing in it, as does creation of art and the creation of anything, really.
Yeah.
sirve sangre, eres sin sangre, se cara. Arabón, arabón, bom, bom, bom.
Today, like every other day, we wake up empty and frightened. Don't open the door to the study and begin reading. Take down a musical instrument. Let the beauty we love be what we do. There are hundreds of ways to kneel and kiss the ground. Would you like to have revealed to you the truth of the friend? Leave the rhyme and descend into the pith. Fold within fold, the beloved drowns in his own being. This world is drenched in that drowning.
Oh, Mama, oh, Mama, Shiva.
I am so small, I can barely be seen. How can this great love be inside me? Look at your eyes. They are small, but they see enormous things. Pale sunlight, pale the wall. Love moves away. The light changes. I need more grace than I thought. So there can be an Islamic Rumi, and there is, of course, and there can be a Christian Rumi, and there's all different faiths. There can be a Buddhist Rumi, too. And there can be an all-religion Rumi. I think it's okay now to say that you're all religions, that you're no religion, that you're all of them. When you are with everyone but me, you're with no one. When you are with no one but me, you're with everyone. Instead of being so bound up with everyone, be everyone. When you become that many, you are nothing. Empty. So that's what I love about the work with Rumi, is that something is just happening. I just got to get out of the way, you know. And when I work on the poem and it's really going well,
I do finish the 30 minutes and then I just bow. I just, something in me wants to bow. Like, thank you. You know. One night, a man was crying, Allah, 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 Allah. His lips grew sweet with the praising, until a cynic said, so I have heard you calling out, but have you ever gotten any response? The man had no answer for that. He quit praying and fell into a confused sleep, where he dreamed he saw Hitter, the guide of souls, in a thick green foliage. Why did you stop praising? Why did you stop praising? Because I never heard anything back. This longing you express is the return message, the grief you cry out from draws you toward union, your pure sadness that wants help, your pure sadness that wants help is the secret cup. Listen to the moan of a dog for its master. That whining is the connection. That whining is the connection. There are love dogs no one knows the names of. There are love dogs no one knows the names of. Give your life to be one of them. One night a man was crying. One night a woman was crying.
Ilaha. And I am another yourself. And at this moment, let's keep that thought in mind that Mikos was telling us, that the records of the crystals are there not just to sit around. They are vibrating, they are alive, and they are here to ensure the outcome is the highest good of all concerned. Let it be so, Ahomi Takuyasin. And I invite you to come to Cheryl Croce's extended empowerment of the times that we are in, to make sure to lead that path of the good red road for all sentient beings on this good red road, to come to their highest good. And that's the same number is here, 213-342-3000. And it's 946-7441 pound. That's the number for the code. And it's at 9:15 on Eastern time and 6:15 on Pacific time. Sunday evening and Monday evening. Hope to see you there, everyone. And until next time on this great radio station, we'll see you in the light of joy and peace and on that good way road, inshallah, and namaste. Aho mitakuyasin. Sat nam.
Sat nam ji.